Hope and Glory, next Tuesday to Thursday afternoon at 2:15 on Radio 4.
The world belongs to you too!
Yes, brother.
And hear the stories so far on BBC Sounds.
On 92 to 95 FM, on BBC Sounds and on digital radio. This is BBC Radio 4.
Good morning, it's 6 o'clock on Friday the 20th of March. This is Today with Anna Foster in Salford and Simon Jack in London.
Good morning. The headlines today. Oil and gas prices have fallen back after the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said he'd agreed to President Trump's request to hold off on further attacks on Iranian gas fields. And the family of a sixth former who died in the meningitis outbreak in Kent have joined calls for the vaccination programme to be extended to teenagers and young adults.
Also in today's programme, we have a special report from the Iranian border. As the Persian New Year dawns, families fleeing, their future uncertain.
Many people are mourning.
Will you celebrate at all?
No. We want people of the world to understand my country. Very hard.
And?
A career spanning six decades, over 30 albums, and yet to the world she's still just Mick Jagger's ex-girlfriend.
A new film looks at the life of the extraordinary Marianne Faithfull. We'll speak to the directors before 9 o'clock. The BBC News this morning is read by Lisa Costello.
Explosions have been heard in Tehran overnight as Iranians mark Nowruz, the Persian New Year. The Israeli military said it was carrying out another wave of airstrikes targeting infrastructure used by the Iranian regime. Oil and gas prices have fallen back after Israel promised to stop attacking Iranian energy infrastructure, and European nations offered help to secure passage for ships through the Strait of Hormuz. From Jerusalem, our Middle East correspondent Yulan Nell reports.
There have been more heavy explosions reported in Tehran amid new Israeli strikes after Iran launched rounds of missiles at Jerusalem overnight. The loud thuds of interceptions were repeatedly heard overhead here. Earlier, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had told journalists that Iran was now decimated and unable to enrich uranium or manufacture ballistic missiles. This week, as Iran retaliated for Israel's strike on its vast South Pass gas field, global energy prices soared. But they've now begun to fall back with Israel's pledge to refrain from similar strikes and US plans to boost oil output. There was also a joint statement yesterday in which the UK, France, Japan and others expressed what they said was their readiness to contribute to appropriate efforts to ensure safe passage through the Strait of Hormuz.
A number of Gulf countries are again being attacked by Iran. In Kuwait, state media reported that drones had caused a fire at an oil refinery. The United Arab Emirates said its air defences were having to respond to incoming missiles and drones. Bahrain said a warehouse was set alight by shrapnel from what it called Iranian aggression. Venezuela's interim president, Delcy Rodriguez, has replaced the country's senior military commanders a day after she brought in a new defence minister. It's the latest change at the top of the Venezuelan establishment since the US military captured the former leader Nicolas Maduro in January. Ms. Rodriguez, who'd been Mr. Maduro's vice president, has been cooperating with President Trump ever since. The father of a sixth form student who died in the meningitis B outbreak in Kent has joined calls for the national vaccination programme to be extended to teenagers and young adults. Michael Kenny said his family's devastation was immeasurable after the death of his 18-year-old daughter Juliet. There are now 27 either suspected or confirmed cases. Here's Nick Johnson.
Juliet Kenny's father, Michael, said his daughter's impact on this world must be lasting change. The MenB vaccine has been offered on the NHS to babies and young children since 2015. The charity Meningitis Research Foundation said its calls for the immunisation to be offered to all at-risk groups at the time was not taken forward, as it was judged not to be cost-effective. Speaking on a visit to the University of Kent, the Health Secretary Wes Streeting said he'd asked the government's independent advisers on vaccinations to revisit their recommendation.
Attending a football match in England and Wales without a ticket will become a criminal offence under new laws that come into force ahead of this weekend's Carabao Cup final at Wembley. At the same stadium in 2021, thousands of ticketless fans forced their way into England's European Championship final against Italy. The Policing and Crime Minister, Sarah Jones, MP, says the disorder that day proved the rules needed to change.
We were so lucky that we didn't see deaths, and the Louise Casey report after that was really clear at what could have happened and how we needed to make sure we acted so that we can make sure there are consequences. And those consequences could be a fine of up to £1,000 or could be a football banning order for up to 5 years.
The leader of the Green Party of England and Wales, Zach Polanski, has said becoming Prime Minister is definitely on his mind because he keeps being asked about it. But Mr. Polanski told Political Thinking with Nick Robinson that his immediate ambition was to have enough MPs to hold the balance of power if there's a hung parliament after the next general election. The Greens now have five MPs, but Mr. Polanski said his target for how many seats they could win was changing.
I was talking about 30 to 40 when I ran for leader, and that felt very ambitious to journalists, understandably, to go from four at that time to 30. Now saying that, it feels under-ambitious.
A report by MPs says the true scale of the impact of coastal erosion on communities around the UK is not being fully recognised by the government. The Environment, Food and Rural Affairs Committee heard evidence from residents who say the issue is causing huge financial and psychological pain. Our environment correspondent Matt McGrath reports.
Some 10,000 properties around the UK's coast face the threat of destruction as a result of shoreline erosion over the next 80 years. But the MPs say the potential loss of a house is made worse by the mental, emotional and financial anxieties borne by coastal communities. The MPs are calling for improvements to relocation, insurance and demolition support, and are recommending information on erosion and landslide risks be required in the home buying process. The government says it will always support coastal communities to adapt where the forces of nature make long-term defence impossible.
NASA's huge moon rocket has started its four-mile journey back to the launch pad at Cape Canaveral in Florida after repairs for technical problems discovered last month. Standing nearly 100 metres tall, the rocket is being carried vertically on the back of a transporter vehicle at around 1 mile an hour, but slower uphill and round corners. It's hoped that it will launch at the beginning of April.
Lisa, thank you very much indeed. It's 7 minutes past six now. Let's take an early look at the weather for the day. Here's Sarah Keith-Lucas. Morning.
Good morning, Anna. Yes, it's looking fine and dry again for many of us today, and there'll be some pleasant spring sunshine around, but it might take its time to develop because we've got some dense fog patches around, so it's a bit of a misty, murky start to the day, and that mist and fog will slowly clear. So the areas seeing the most widespread and dense fog this morning are across the Midlands into parts of eastern England, northeast England, Northern Ireland and central Scotland, also seeing some misty, foggy patches around. So they should lift and clear, but for places like the Vale of York, for instance, also the Welsh Marches, some of that fog could linger for a good part of the day. But sunshine developing gradually, light winds too, and temperatures are going to do pretty well for the time of year. So most of us will see highs between about 13 to 15 degrees. But for Northern Ireland and northeast Scotland, we could locally see 18 Celsius, possibly the warmest day of the year so far there. Light winds for most, but just breezy along the south coast at times. And then through tonight, again, it looks dry. There'll be some more mist and fog forming through tonight, probably not quite as extensive as it has been last night. The weekend looks mostly dry and settled too. There'll just be a little bit more cloud working into the far northwest through the weekend, bringing the odd spot of rain, particularly by Sunday, and that hints of things changing a little bit, so cooler and more unsettled gradually through next week, but the next few days do enjoy the spring sunshine.
Thanks very much, Sarah. Let's have a look at the morning's papers, and the effect on the world energy markets is making the front of most papers. A series of strikes on energy infrastructure across the Middle East could unleash a mortgage shock for millions, according to the Daily Mail. The paper warns of the prospect of three interest rate rises this year. The Daily Express says the Bank of England stands ready to ramp up interest rates, increasing the risk of an inflation surge. Hell's Bills is the Sun's headline. It warns energy bills could jump by as much as £300 a year. The Guardian notes fears of a global energy crisis are growing. Bond and equity markets fell yesterday as a result of the strikes, as the Financial Times. Markets tumble as investors price in protracted energy shock, reads its headline.
There are some other stories around this morning as well. The Daily Telegraph says the head of the Civil Services Ethics Team, Darren Tierney, twice offered to question Lord Mandelson about his links to Jeffrey Epstein. This was before his appointment as US ambassador. Downing Street has disputed that claim. Lord Mandelson was sacked from the role last year, you'll remember, after the extent of his friendship with the convicted sex offender came to light.
And the Times says police are likely to widen their investigation into Andrew Mountbatten Windsor beyond allegations of misconduct in public office. The former prince was arrested last month on suspicion of the offence relating to his time as a government trade envoy. The paper says the specific charge is a difficult one to prosecute. Mr. Mountbatten Windsor has previously denied any wrongdoing in relation to Epstein. He's not commented on the specific allegations linked to the release of millions of Epstein files in January.
The Daily Mirror this morning leads on the latest report from the COVID inquiry, which we will also look at later in the programme this morning, which said that NHS staff put their lives on the line and saved the service from collapse during the pandemic. They saved us and NHS, reads the Mirror's headline this morning. Also, The Guardian says that scientists have identified a molecule in python blood that could be used in future obesity drugs. According to the report, the metabolism of wild Burmese pythons increases 4,000 times in the hours after they've eaten.
And the team behind the digital concert ABBA Voyage has secured Tina Turner's image and music rights, according to the Metro. The paper says the singer, who died in 2023, could strut the stage again. The paper's headline, Tina Returner.
Clever. 6:10 now. The family of a teenage girl who died from meningitis in the Kent outbreak are calling for better protection for young people. Nick Johnson is our correspondent looking at this. Nick, we've seen people, young people mainly, queuing up for vaccines. What's the latest with that?
Yeah, well, those young people are still queuing. We've got 27 either suspected or confirmed cases in Kent. We've seen, as you say, queues of young people for the last couple of days queuing for their vaccinations on the university campus. 1,600 jabs were administered as of yesterday evening, and some students were queuing for such a long time that they had to be turned away, not because of a shortage of vaccines, but they were told to come back the next day. Now, the number of students who are eligible for this vaccine in the local area has increased now. We now understand that anyone who attended that nightclub in Canterbury, Club Chemistry, where it's thought this outbreak is centred upon, between the 5th and the 15th of March can now get vaccinated. So there are clinics at the university, but also some in the local area as well.
And we mentioned Juliet Kenny there, 18 years old, what her family have had to say. They want her loss to become a legacy. They want things to change as a result.
Yeah, they've said they want Juliet's legacy to be one of lasting change. And that legacy they want is for the MenB, the Meningitis B vaccination programme, to be extended to include teenagers and young adults. Now, the MenB vaccine was rolled out on the NHS in 2015, but currently it's only available to babies and young children. And the charity Meningitis Research Foundation said at the time it did call for that vaccine to be given to all at-risk groups, but was told that that wasn't cost-effective. And indeed, we've seen over the past day or so people around the country trying to get this vaccine, and they have to pay around £200 to do so. And Juliet Kenny's family say they believe the ability to pay should not be a barrier when protecting against meningitis. We have heard from the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, who has addressed this directly. He's said he's already asked the JCVI, the government's independent panel of experts, to revisit their initial recommendation in light of the Kent outbreak. And he said he will act upon their advice.
Thank you, Nick. That's Nick Johnson.
It is 6:13. What's happening to the UK's coastline? A new report from DEFRA says it's crumbling faster than thought in some areas and having some profound effects on communities there. Matt McGrath is our environment correspondent. Morning, Matt. What's happening and where?
Yeah, this is the report from MPs, Simon, looking at the coastal communities across the UK which are suffering from it. And they're looking particularly at the impacts on people. They took evidence from a range of people and communities around the area. And the words that come out of it are like grief, anger, fear, division in families, people not wanting to talk about the question, not wanting to highlight the plight and the risk and draw attention to it. So there's a great deal in this report on what people are really suffering in these various communities, talking about 10,000 properties potentially at risk over the next 80 years or so all around the country. in Haysborough in Norfolk, one of the most badly hit places. They've lost 34 homes over the last 20 years. The medieval parish church is just 80 metres away from the from the edge now. And the report is basically calling for a range of actions from government to try and take into account the impact on people and to actually do something practical to help them.
Such as what? And what has the government said?
Yeah, so they're really asking for a number of things, such as greater help with adaptation to the situation. They want more money, basically, to put more insurance schemes in place, similar to the flood scheme that they've got for the highest risk properties. They want capital erosion assistance grants to be increased, and they want relocation schemes, which are being piloted at the moment, to be put on a national basis. I think their most distinctive message, though, is they want the house buying process. They want people who are buying houses to be made aware of the risks about erosion and landslide, and they want to make that mandatory. And they say that at the moment there are tools like the National Coastal Erosion Risks Map, which are not being brought to people's attention. They think that's the most perhaps the most pressing issue that they can give to people.
All right. Matt, thank you very much, Steve. Matt McGrath there, our environment correspondent.
It's 6:15. As we were hearing in the paper review just a minute or two ago, there's growing concern that the conflict in Iran is going to push up the cost of borrowing and mean a spike in inflation. Felicity Hannah's here with more on how the US-Israel war is feeding into the UK economy and the rest of the business news as well. Morning, Felicity.
Good morning, yes. And it's already having a very, very visible impact. Traders had at one point been expecting a cut in the Bank of England's interest rates this week, but the war in Iran meant all members of the bank's Monetary Policy Committee voted unanimously to hold rates at 3.75%. And instead of further rate cuts this year, which had been expected, the committee warned deepening inflation could lead to rate hikes potentially. Let's talk to Rob Wood, who's chief UK economist at Pantheon Macroeconomics, the economic intelligence firm. Rob, you're also a former head of the Bank of England's UK forecast team, so you're a good man to talk to about this. This is a wave of inflation, isn't it, washing up at the Bank of England's door?
Good morning. Yes, unfortunately, higher energy prices will push up UK inflation. If they stay here, of course, we don't know exactly how the war is going to evolve. So the Bank of England and everyone else is very uncertain about where energy prices will go and how long they will stay here. But certainly where they are today means that inflation will pick up this year, maybe to 4%, maybe higher.
Andrew Bailey says, the governor says, we're now looking at a path of inflation, which is not the one we were looking at in the last meeting. Things have changed very, very fast, haven't they?
They have, yes. The oil prices increased very sharply. It was above $110 a barrel yesterday. It was around 70 before the attacks on Iran. The UK is actually also really dependent on natural gas imports, of course, for heating and cooking and so on, much more so for inflation matters on that. And the price of that shot up very sharply yesterday after Iran's retaliation against against attacks on its energy supplies. Those two things really changed the inflation outlook. Before, inflation was likely to fall close to 2%. Which is the Bank of England's target, is what it has to hit. Likely to get there sometime this spring. Now, we probably won't see inflation fall much below 3%. And as I say, it's probably going to head above 4% if gas and oil prices stay where they are.
So we instead of a cut, we had that unanimous hold from the Monetary Policy Committee at the Bank of England, the potential for rate hikes. But the governor of the Bank of England, Andrew Bailey, did say markets were getting ahead of themselves by assuming there could be several hikes this year. What are you expecting?
At the moment, I'm expecting the Bank of England to keep interest rates on hold for all of this year. That's quite a change from before the war, when the bank had been expected to cut a couple of times by markets. Mm. Now, look, the bank, of course, does not want to raise interest rates if it doesn't have to. It doesn't want to create huge damage in the economy. But unfortunately, it also needs to keep inflation close to 2%. It's what it calls a really difficult trade-off. It will have to raise interest rates to keep inflation down, but it doesn't want to do too much to damage the economy. So it has a very difficult choice to make there. They won't know how many interest rate increases they will need. But what Andrew Bailey is certainly flagging is that it's possible That they will need to increase interest rates. And if we see gas and energy prices where they were yesterday morning, they've since fallen a little bit, but if they were where they were yesterday morning, an interest rate increase is not out of the question at all.
Can the bank do anything to reduce the impact on the economy?
No, the Bank of England has one tool, that's the interest rate. So, I mean, raising interest rates will reduce the impact of we'll make sure that inflation comes back to the 2% target eventually. Other than that, this is out of the Bank of England's control. Of course, in the previous energy price surge after Russia's invasion of Ukraine, the government took action to cap utility prices. So if there were any actions required to address this near-term inflation spike, it would fall to the government in the first instance. The Bank of England's job is to bring inflation down after a year or two, not in the near term.
Rob Wood, Chief UK Economist at Pantheon Macroeconomics. Thank you very much indeed. Well, listening to that is Victoria Scholar, Head of Investment for Interactive Investor. Victoria, this all puts pressure on the consumer, as Rob was outlining, but also on the government, of course, as well. And not just because there's the potential for increased costs for them in terms of consumer support, but the UK bond market tumbled, didn't it, as Bank of England officials warned of those possible future interest rate rises. And that pushes up the cost of government borrowing.
Yes, that's right. We saw quite a lot of indiscriminate selling across markets yesterday, with the FTSE considerably lower and pain in the gilt market as well. We saw one of the biggest sell-offs in two-year gilts on record, and the yield on the 10-year was close to 2008 levels. And this is essentially because inflation is the enemy of the bond market, and the risk of higher inflation and the likelihood of higher for longer interest rates is punishing those bond prices and pushing up yields, so making it more expensive for the government to borrow.
And of course, the key inflationary driver is that energy disruption we're seeing around Iran. This week's attacks on oil and gas infrastructure in Iran and in the wider Gulf have caused prices to surge even higher. Just catch us up. What are we seeing this morning?
So we're seeing a little bit of that ease off after yesterday's sharp rally. So we're seeing that Brent crude is down by about 1%, trading around $107 a barrel. This is partly because we've heard that world leaders are trying to work towards an end to the war and restart the safe passage through the Strait of Hormuz. Trump said he's not considering troops on the ground. And Scott Bessent, the Treasury Secretary, said that he's thinking about lifting sanctions on Iranian crude. So that could help ease some of those supply pressures. But to put it into context, we know that Brent is up sharply this year, about 70% and around 45% over the last month.
OK, and this all has a knock-on impact, doesn't it? We've seen it with house builders, with concerns about mortgages, Persimmon, Barratt Redrow, some of the biggest fallers on the FTSE yesterday. But it's also hitting the aviation industry, isn't it? The supply of jet fuel is a particular worry.
Yes, that's right. We've seen that jet fuel costs have surged, and there are growing concerns about shortages in the airline industry. And it's reportedly looking at contingency plans to try and deal with these pressures. Delta is one airline that said that jet fuel is going to add $400 million to its costs in March alone. And we know that carriers do hedge out part of their risk at least, but it could still lead to higher prices for passengers with airfares going up. And we've seen that reflected in terms of airline shares that were hit hard yesterday, the likes of Air France, IAG and Ryanair all falling quite sharply because of these worries about spiking fuel prices at a time when the sector is already under pressure from travel disruption that's impacted popular routes like to Dubai.
It just shows the ongoing fallout, doesn't it? Victoria Scholar, Head of Investment for Interactive Investor. Thank you very much indeed. Now, that can also have a big impact on energy intensive businesses in the UK who are facing higher energy costs in an already challenging environment, like Robinson Brothers, who I spoke to earlier.
Go back to 2023, we were hedged, so we had bought ahead. Therefore, our energy bill was about £680,000. When we came off that hedge in 2023, it went up to £1.7 million.
Wow.
So what can I get frustrated? Before the current crisis, there was still a crisis here.
So that was Adrian Hanrahan, Managing Director of Robinson Brothers, speaking to me earlier. Let's chat to Stephen Phipson, who's Chief Executive of Make UK, which represents manufacturers in the United Kingdom. Stephen, there's no price cap for businesses. So what does the situation mean for your members?
Well, good morning. It's a very difficult, worrying time at the moment. We were already struggling with, as you heard, with some of the highest industrial energy costs in the world in the UK, which has been a real challenge for manufacturers and something we've been discussing with government. And of course, what we have got now is the situation where about a third of businesses, around 30%, are renewing their contracts, their energy contracts in April. And so a lot of manufacturers are very concerned about what that's going to mean. And I think as similar stories, we're going to hear lots more companies thinking about doubling the cost of the energy that they use, which is very concerning.
What about the British Industry Supercharger Scheme, which launched in 2024, designed to lower electricity costs for energy-intensive industries like steel, paper, glass? Is that having enough of an impact?
That was a good intervention by government. It took off a number of those levies that sit on top of the wholesale cost of energy. And in fact, the business secretary went further. Peter Carr this year actually increased the amount of discount there are on those levies, which brings us down roughly to the same sort of price as European energy costs. So that really does help those energy intensive, which is steel, chemicals, glass manufacturers, those sorts of things. But we have to just put that in perspective. That helps around about 450 businesses in the UK. And we've got around about 150,000 manufacturing businesses in total. So whilst that helps those energy intensives, the real concern is the smaller businesses in the supply chain. Those businesses are the ones that will be most affected by the renewal of the energy contracts that's coming up in April.
A government spokesperson said that they've published a new steel strategy that's going to boost advanced manufacturing across the economy, that they're working with all sectors to understand the impact of the situation in the Middle East and explore potential solutions. Are you making representations to the government, and what are you asking for?
Well, absolutely. And the steel strategy was another great step forward, again, for that one sort of sector of the manufacturing area. And when the government published the industrial strategy last year, they also had in there a concept of what they call the British Industrial Competitiveness Scheme, which is a scheme for wider manufacturers and taking off a number of those levies that are on the wholesale cost of energy. Not quite as much discount as we see in supercharger for energy intensives, but it is for the rest of manufacturing. But that's not scheduled to come in until 2027. So one of the points we're making to government is we need to bring that forward to enable, you know, those discounts to be realised by manufacturers now. Mm. And there is one other important point.
Quickly, if you can.
Okay, it's not just about costs. It's also about security of supply. Oil is used in many manufacturing products like plastics and chemicals, etc. Mm. So the other concern is that if we end up in a shortage situation, a lot of those base materials will be under pressure.
Stephen Phipson, Chief Executive of Make UK. Thank you very much.
And thank you, Fliss. It's 27 minutes past six. Let's get some sport with Mike Williams. Morning, Mike.
Morning, Simon. Two English sides have made it through to the quarterfinals of the Europa League.
Aston Villa make it 3-0 on aggregate. There's no coming back for Lille now. Villa fans around us bid adieu to their French opponents.
Chalufia, right-footed, runs up. Oh, he's fallen over! And it's gone over the crossbar! And Forest are in the Europa League quarterfinals. The European odyssey continues.
Yeah, great night for Aston Villa and Nottingham Forest. Both are through to the last eight of the Europa League. Forest are through to European quarterfinal for the first time in 30 years. They took their tie with the Danish side Midtjylland to extra time before prevailing in a penalty shootout. Here is their midfielder, Ryan Yates.
Yeah, lads got the job done really well, and it takes ball, it takes courage, and we do practice them. As I've said many times, it's all about winning in cup competitions. It's fantastic. We need to use this now. We need to keep pushing. We thoroughly deserve to get through. We need to just keep our feet on the ground and keep pushing for more.
As for Aston Villa, a 2-0 home victory over Lille did the job for them in their second leg. They are through to the last eight, where they will face Bologna. As for Nottingham Forest, Porto await them in the next round. Those quarterfinals taking place next month. In the Conference League, Ismail Assar scored twice as Crystal Palace edged past nine-man AEK Larnaca 2-1 after extra time to move into the quarterfinals. They have now set up a meeting with Fiorentina in in the quarterfinals. Elsewhere in football, Thomas Tuchel will announce his England squad today for England's final two matches on home soil before this summer's World Cup. They are friendlies against Uruguay and Japan at the end of this month. We will look ahead to that squad announcement in the next hour of the programme. And one other interesting football line announced yesterday: every team in FIFA's women's tournaments in the future must include at least one female head coach or assistant coach, following introduction of new regulations announced yesterday. In rugby league, Wigan Warriors kept up their 100% record in the Super League last night. They beat newcomers York Knights by 23 points to 22. And in tennis at the Miami Open, Britain's Fran Jones recorded an impressive victory yesterday, beating the veteran Venus Williams in straight sets in the first round.
Thank you, Mike. Next week, we'll find out what it takes to be a politician in the modern era.
On BBC Radio 4, we're dealing with a lot of technological change, questions of economy, geopolitics.
I'm Isabel Hardman. In my new series, I'm asking if our politicians have the modern skills they need to do their jobs.
What happens in the Chamber of the Commons has become detached from what I think a lot of people think of as real politics.
I'll speak to politicians and those who advise and observe them.
People who have grown up on the internet and who have a very sophisticated understanding of when they are being made to make something go viral.
What do our politicians need to know now? With me, Isabel Hardman, on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds, next Monday to Friday at 1:45.
The time is 6:30. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4. Anna Foster in Salford, Simon Jack in London, and Lisa Costello has a summary of the news.
Explosions have been heard in Tehran overnight as Iranians mark Nowruz, the Persian New Year. There's been a fall in gas and oil prices after Israel promised to stop attacking Iranian energy infrastructure, and European nations offered help to secure passage for ships through the Strait of Hormuz. A number of Gulf countries are again coming under attack from drones and missiles fired by Iran. In Kuwait, local media report that the attacks have caused a fire at an oil refinery. The United Arab Emirates said its air defences were having to respond to incoming missiles and drones. Venezuela's interim president, Delcy Rodriguez, has replaced the country's senior military commanders a day after she brought in a new defence minister. Ms. Rodriguez, the country's former vice president, has been cooperating with President Trump since the US military captured the former leader, Nicolas Maduro, in January. The father of a sixth form student who died in the meningitis B outbreak in Kent has joined calls for the national vaccination programme to be extended to teenagers and young adults. Michael Kenny said his family's devastation was immeasurable after the death of 18-year-old Juliet. The MenB vaccine has been offered on the NHS to babies and young children since 2015. Attending a football match in England and Wales without a ticket has become a criminal offence ahead of this weekend's Carabao Cup final. Offenders face a fine of up to £1,000 and a ban of up to 5 years. The change comes after thousands of ticketless fans forced their way into England men's Euro final against Italy at Wembley in 2021. NASA's huge moon rocket has started its four-mile journey back to the launch pad in Florida after undergoing repairs for technical problems. Nearly 100 metres tall, the rocket is being carried on the back of a transporter vehicle at around 1 mile an hour. It's hoped that it will launch at the beginning of April.
Thank you, Lisa. It's 28 minutes to seven. There have been more Iranian attacks on Gulf states overnight as Qatar called that strike on its Ras Laffan gas facility a dangerous escalation. In the last few hours, there have been blasts heard in Tehran, more interceptions over Jerusalem, also over central Israel just in the last half hour or so. Frank Gardner, our security correspondent, is still in Doha. Frank, interesting to see what the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had to say yesterday, in particular that the US had asked them to hold off attacking Iranian gas fields.
Yes, and the Israelis have said they're going to comply with that. I spoke to the Israelis yesterday, and it was pretty interesting. They left me in no doubt that from their point of view, they did inform the Americans that they were going to hit the South Pars gas field. I mean, when we say gas field, we're talking about the processing facilities onshore that process the gas that comes from the gas field, and they turn it into liquid natural gas. So they say that there is absolutely no distance between them and the Americans. They are coordinating incredibly closely. That's not the view that's coming from DC, that there does seem to be some divergence. I certainly think the Israelis have got a pretty long list of targets they want to work their way through. They seem to possibly be more forward-leaning, more aggressive than the Americans on this campaign. Donald Trump, I think, has got constraints on him that the Israelis don't have, in that, you know, he was elected into office precisely not to do this kind of thing, to get dragged into a conflict with no easy off-ramps that's got huge unintended consequences, like the partial closure of the Strait of Hormuz, the driving up of oil and gas prices, and instability in the area. And he's got his Gulf Arab allies saying, you know, what are you doing? This is mayhem in our area.
Yeah, all of which, Frank, we're going to discuss this through the programme this morning. We keep using this expression off-ramp, don't we? But it makes it enormously difficult to see what that might look like.
Yeah, but, I mean, I think there must have been a presumption. I mean, I don't have an inside knowledge on this, but there must have been a presumption in both US Central Command and the White House that the sheer weight, the shock and awe of US military firepower, which is vastly superior to what Iran could muster. They've got total air superiority. You know, they can fly their planes all over Iran without fear of being shot down, almost. And yet, the Islamic Republic regime has neither crumbled nor capitulated. I think there must have been an expectation that by hitting so many commanders, so many IRGC bases, taking out all their missile launchers, that they would just throw up their hands in despair and say, okay, we give up. What are your demands? Well, you know, that hasn't happened. Iran has been defiant right from the beginning, and they've clearly, you know, they've got 31 provinces, and there's a degree of autonomy in those provinces as to how the Iranian Revolutionary Guards Corps operates, and they carry on firing these drones and missiles at this side of the Gulf. I mean, you mentioned it there, so in Kuwait, for example, Amina Abdullah and Amina Al-Ahmadi, refineries have been hit. The Saudis are really angry that they're getting hit because these Gulf countries, while they don't like the Islamic Republic regime in Iran, they haven't taken part actively in this war, and yet they're getting pummeled.
Frank, thank you. Frank Garner there, our security correspondent in Doha.
Now, are there cracks opening up in the ranks of Labour MPs over immigration policy? The Home Secretary's plan, Shabana Mahmood's plan, to double the length of time it takes to establish indefinite leave to remain from 5 to 10 years is facing a backlash from Labour MPs. Ian Watson is our political correspondent. Another fault line in the Labour Party, Ian?
Yes, that's right, I think, Simon. Essentially, with something of a flourish, that the Home Secretary unveiled her plans based on some of the plans that Labour's sister party, the Social Democrats, have been implementing successfully in Denmark to try to neutralise this toxic issue of immigration. Part of that was saying that it would have to take longer for people to be in this country before they could get permanent residency status, indefinite leave to remain. Up to 10 years in most cases, longer for care workers, longer still for refugees. And we are now beginning to see something of a backlash against that because, there's two things which are annoying Labour MPs. The first is that there will not be a parliamentary vote on these changes. They don't require primary legislation, so that's of concern. The other concern, which was highlighted in explosive intervention earlier this week by the former deputy leader Angela Rayner, is that these changes would apply retrospectively. So people who are already in the country would face a longer wait. The Home Office say that's essential because the so-called Boris wave, as critics call it, the big increase in net migration, has added more than 2 million people to the UK population. They're about to become eligible for full access to the British welfare state. So Shabana Mahmood is saying we need to lengthen that time. But around 100 Labour MPs have written to the Home Secretary expressing their concerns. And now what they're planning to do is to try to have, using arcane parliamentary procedures, but try to have a symbolic vote in Parliament. That can't change the rules, but what it can do is potentially advertise the divisions in Labour's ranks so you don't neutralise that toxic issue, you in fact highlight it. And their thinking is that by effectively threatening to do that, perhaps they can force a rethink by government ministers.
Yeah, and you mentioned Angela Rayner there as sort of the de facto leader of this. It does feel like not the first time she's been perhaps on manoeuvres.
Well, I think certainly if you were somebody who wanted to keep your options open for any future leadership contest, and we don't know where we're going to be following the May elections in Scotland, Wales and for English councils, then this is one issue that would appeal to the so-called soft left of the Labour Party, something where they are already concerned. She was also very influential, even though she was in the back benches. For example, she made sure that the Mandelson documents went to the Intelligence and Security Committee. The government had to do an amendment on the day of that debate. So she can, when she chooses, throw her weight around. To be fair, though, the thing that she's concerned about is not the immigration changes across the board. She is focusing very much on the retrospective nature, and that's where she's applying pressure to the government. And I'm told that isn't just being on manoeuvres, that is something which she genuinely feels very strongly about.
OK. Ian, thank you. Ian Watson, our political correspondent. And we will be speaking to one of the Labour MPs who signed this letter, Tony Vaughan, just after 7 o'clock.
Just coming round to 20 to 7 now. Edinburgh Council has approved a temporary ban on developing AI data centres there over concerns about their environmental impact. Zoe Kleinman, our technology editor, is with us. Zoe, this is it's going to be the great push and pull for a while now, I think, isn't it? Big carbon footprint on the one hand, but something that people want and need on the other.
I think you're absolutely right, Anna. And Edinburgh Council's decision here to pause the development of these large data centres is definitely at odds with the rest of the UK, because the country's really going for it. You know, we've got dozens of them planned or already underway elsewhere. And the issue is with hyperscale data centres. Now, they are as massive as they sound, essentially. They're enormous warehouses full of powerful computers, and they're needed to power AI. We all know the government has made that a big priority for economic growth here. But the issue for Edinburgh, as you say, is that the new data centres are supposed to be green, but there's no actual definition of what a green data centre is. And the council's green group says that needs to be sorted out because, as you say, of their environmental impact. You know, we know they're really energy hungry and we know that they can use a lot of water. Campaigners are concerned that without actual rules, data centre developers might kind of get around it by putting in these little green measures, you know, like maybe more efficient flushing toilets that tick a box somewhere but aren't actually affecting their carbon footprint very much. The other thing is that the timing of this couldn't be more awkward. The council voted on this last night, and I'm actually talking to you from Edinburgh this morning because the Scottish Government is planning to launch its new AI strategy here a little bit later on.
Yeah, tell us more about that, Zoe.
We do know that I can't tell you a lot because it hasn't happened yet, but we do know that...
that was a bad question then, wasn't it? It's fine to say that.
I can speculate wildly, if you like. The Scottish Government is planning to support the AI priority like the rest of the UK is. And my understanding is that there is going to be an event later on at which all will be revealed. Perhaps I can tell you more about it tomorrow, Anna.
Beautifully saved. Thank you, Zoe. That's our technology editor, Zoe Kleinman.
Let's have a quick look inside some of the papers there. I'm going to look at the FT's Alphaville section, because they've got this headline saying demand destruction has begun. Now, that is a term used by economists for when things start getting so expensive that you stop doing them. And they're saying it's not so much in the UK, but in Asia, there's a lot of examples of, you know, the Philippines and Sri Lanka have instituted 4-day work weeks to curb diesel use. They talk about Bangladesh has brought forward a holiday and allowed universities to close early to save fuel. So just jet fuel approaching $200 billion a barrel. Several Asian airlines, including Qantas, Air India, Cathay Pacific and others, have introduced phased fuel surcharges, and long-haul Air India tickets from Asia to Europe now carry another $125 to $200 surcharge. So it's just some examples of how the very energy-dependent Asia is actually beginning to curtail some economic activity in the light, in the face of some of these surging oil prices. Well, that was pretty interesting.
Yeah. No, I agree, actually. It's the sort of thing we talk about, the economic impact and things like oil can not necessarily feel like they trickle down to your everyday life, even though they do, of course, at places like the petrol pump and in everything, everyday goods, price of food at the supermarket. What you were saying about air travel, that's picked up inside The Guardian as well, because airlines are urging people to book early to avoid fare rises, which would be a very sensible thing to do. But then, of course, depending on the type of holiday you're booking, if you book too early and it's not a package, for example, and you need to start cancelling bits of it here, there and everywhere, it's just that unpredictability at the moment, isn't it? It's the time of year when people start to look ahead to the summer, look ahead to the school holidays, might think about booking hotels and flights. And it's one of those moments, and you can see for the travel industry, they really want people to stay on board, to stay engaged, to keep booking. But it is a complicated moment for that and a difficult one for them. Now, let's talk about what happened yesterday in Parliament, shall we? As we do at every time, at this time every morning. There was fury from some opposition and Labour MPs yesterday, particularly at the government's decision, which we'll look at in more depth later in the programme, to cut aid spending and divert money to defence instead. The Foreign Secretary, for her part, blamed the Conservatives for having hollowed out defence spending in previous years. Susan Hume reports.
It's just as well being a minister is not a popularity contest.
This is a shameful moment.
These cuts do not aid our defence. They make the whole world more vulnerable.
Utterly shameful.
It's surely madness.
Well, they were all upset at the government's decision to cut the budget for UK overseas aid to 0.3% of national income. It means that next year aid spending will be more than half from what it was in 2021. The Foreign Secretary, Yvette Cooper, explained that as recent weeks had shown, the money was needed elsewhere.
UK jets fly defensive operations in the Middle East, while our carrier strike group has been preparing to head to the High North. In order to fund the additional defence spending, we also had to take the hugely difficult decision to reduce our development budget over the next few years.
She said areas of conflict and need would be prioritised for what money was left, such as Ukraine, Sudan, Lebanon and Gaza, as would support for women and girls. The Conservatives don't disagree with the principle. In fact, cutting the aid budget to fund defence was their idea in the first place. But the Shadow Foreign Minister, Wendy Morton, felt she still didn't have any actual detail more than a year after the plan was announced.
What programmes have been cancelled this year as a result of these reductions? Which partnerships have been scaled back? Which commitments made by this country will no longer be honoured? We on this side of the House are clear. Development spending must be rooted firmly in Britain's national interests.
Yvette Cooper said they wouldn't have to make these choices if the Conservative government hadn't underfunded the UK's defences. Now, a lot of MPs head off to their constituencies on a Thursday, so there weren't many people there for the Foreign Secretary's statement. Speaking for the Lib Dems, Monica Harding wondered
why this extremely important statement on Britain's commitments overseas is announced on a Thursday when most MPs aren't here. Is it perhaps because the government is ashamed of these cuts and wants them to slip out unnoticed?
But Monica Harding tried to make up for all the MPs who weren't there to criticise the minister. She said the Lib Dems opposed these appalling cuts and the damage they'd cause.
Where has the government's full commitment to address climate change gone? Where are the Labour Party's values? Where did it mislay its moral compass? And where is its strategic logic?
On the idea she was trying to sneak this out quietly, Yvette Cooper told her tartly that Thursday was a working day and that the Lib Dems needed to take responsibility for cutting the defence budget under the coalition government. But the Labour chair of the International Development Committee, Sarah Champion, sounded terribly disappointed. She felt it was a false economy.
We've had defence pitched against international development. And actually, if you ask any military person, they will tell you the best line of prevention and first defence is our development money, because it keeps people safe and secure in their homes.
Labour's Nick Smith loyally said he did welcome what he called the reset of overseas development, but he hinted that he hoped for better times to come.
I support the government's decision to invest in our country's security now and our ambition to support development more in the future.
A Conservative former Treasury Minister, Steve Barclay, thought the government was right.
I support prioritising hard power over soft power to protect our national security.
But the criticism of the aid cuts from smaller opposition parties burned hot. The SNP's Chris Law said the cuts would prevent access to life-saving medicine.
In short, these are death sentence cuts.
The Green Party's Ellie Chowne said she had three questions.
First, when will she publish the country allocations so we can see exactly where the axe is falling? Second, how will she ensure that poverty alleviation remains the focus of overseas development assistance in this context? And thirdly, How does she square this with the comments of her own Prime Minister, who previously acknowledged that cutting aid makes the world less secure?
But before Yvette Cooper could get up, the Deputy Speaker, Judith Cummins, intervened.
Foreign Secretary, please answer just one question. Foreign Secretary.
Yvette Cooper laughing before she answered.
If a party that wants to walk away from NATO, they would actually make our defence more expensive harder rather than making sure that we can support both defence and international aid.
Which Ellie Chowns probably felt did not answer even one of her questions, never mind three.
Susan Hume there reporting on some of the challenges ahead, and we'll speak to one of those charities that has been impacted by the cuts on the programme before nine.
It's nearly 11 minutes to seven. Drugs aimed at slowing the progress of Alzheimer's disease were not made available on the NHS after the National Institute for Health and Care Excellent, NICE, judged their benefits too small to justify the cost. But NICE will now have to reconsider that decision after a successful appeal by their manufacturers, one of whom is the drug giant Eli Lilly. Dr. Emily Pegg is Medical Director of Northern Europe for the company and is in the studio with me. Good morning, Dr. Pegg.
Good morning.
What were the grounds of your appeal and on which grounds were you successful?
So we appealed on a number of points to NICE, for example, around the time that we were given for consultation on key documents during the process, including significant cost of infusions to deliver the medicine. We also wanted additional time for us to explain, for example, long-term extension data around the product that wasn't allowed during the process. The committee also failed to consider scenario analyses which included the significant unpaid care costs that are incurred as part of caring for someone with Alzheimer's disease. And also they didn't consider fully, we felt, and appropriately, the utility, that is the impact on quality of life of carers, of people who care for people with Alzheimer's disease.
So that's interesting, because this is expensive. It's £70,000 to £80,000 a year. And what you're saying is that they're not considering the whole system cost, including the lifestyles of the people who care for people with the disease.
Yes, so there is a significant known impact on carers who care for people with Alzheimer's disease, both emotionally but also financially. So we know from some work that has been done by some of the patient advocacy groups that nearly half of patients and carers actually fully fund their own cost at a care of up to £70,000 to £80,000 a year. That's double the UK average salary. And that up to a third of people spend over 100 hours a week caring for someone with Alzheimer's or with dementia. Mm. So there are only 168 hours in the week. That impact is huge.
And then this drug, this is donanemab. Have I pronounced that correctly?
Donanemab, yes.
Donanemab. Obviously, it's 70,000, 80,000. If you wanted to get it adopted and sort of into the mainstream, you could just cut the price. You know, you're a vast, very deep-pocketed pharmaceutical company. Why not do that?
Yeah, so the price is absolutely something we take very seriously. And we price our medicines based on the impact they can have for the individual patient, but also the wider impact for the health system. Caring for these patients with Alzheimer's disease right now without these products is not free. Baroness Casey referenced just recently in a speech that she gave that dementia accounts for over 1 in 10 bed days in acute care. And they also account for 1 in 4 delayed discharges in older adults. So there is a significant impact for the patient and the system. And the costs of caring for patients with dementia in 2024 was £42 billion a year and is projected to rise to £90 billion a year.
But this drug is not a cure for Alzheimer's, is it? It's to slow the advance of it. So it must be very hard to calculate what the additional benefit to the NHS will be if it's just a gradient of decline.
So that is one of the challenges, but we do have a very robust cost effectiveness decision making body in NICE, and they have very robust methodology. What we were keen to highlight in this appeal was that that process was carried out appropriately. And based on the grounds of our appeal, the cumulative impact of the points that we have been successful on has a great potential to be significant on that cost effectiveness decision.
But if you're going to hold the line on your price of £70,000 to £80,000 a year, it seems likely you're going to lose this appeal, aren't you?
So based on the points that have been upheld, we have, we believe, a good chance to demonstrate being cost effective.
But if you thought you could get over the line by, I don't know, making it £50,000 a year, would you do that?
So we will have discussions with NICE and collaborate with them to try and find a way to bring this to
NHS. So the price is on the table as a variable in these discussions?
So the when the data is considered and when we have those grounds of appeal have been upheld and we are able to discuss the data in its full capacity, yeah, we will have those full discussions with NICE to determine.
And what happens now? How quickly will this happen?
So we don't yet know the confirmed timelines. Essentially, the next stage is that we will go back to a final, hopefully, committee meeting. We haven't yet been told when that will be, but we hope it will be as soon as possible so NHS patients aren't kept waiting.
OK. Dr. Emily Pegg, Medical Director for Northern Europe, or for Eli Lilly. I should make it clear that there's no guarantee that these drugs will eventually become available on the NHS. We await further the outcome of that appeal. Thank you.
7 minutes to seven, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says Iran no longer has the ability to enrich uranium or build ballistic missiles after nearly 3 weeks of strikes. Well, Dr. Patricia Lewis is a nuclear physicist and former director of Chatham House's International Security Programme. Good morning.
Good morning.
Can we know that with certainty, particularly on the enriched uranium point?
I think after the attacks last year in June, it's very likely that their enrichment capability has been knocked out, unless, of course, they have a secret facility somewhere else that wasn't known about.
Mm. And how much do we know? Because obviously the International Atomic Energy Agency, they've had inspectors in at some points. There are moments like now where they're blocked for the country, so they need to use other ways, other methods to work out what's going on. Do we think there are secret facilities that are completely unknown?
Yes, well, not completely unknown. So after a fire in Natanz in 2020, the Iranians decided to sort of diversify a bit. And we know of one facility nearby called Pickaxe Mountain. And they've definitely been very busy there over the last few years. So that's of great concern. Did they move the material out in June last year before the attacks? That's quite possible. And would be very, very sensible from their point of view. So it's deep underground and it's fortified. It's a lot of rock, and they've secured the facility as well. So it's probable that they've got stuff there that they don't want anyone to know about it. The IAEA has not been able to go in and inspect since June, of course, last year. So we're without any eyes and ears on the ground.
Yeah, which makes things particularly difficult. And I suppose there's another consideration as well, which is if these facilities are being targeted, as you say, there's always the concern that a partial strike or perhaps you're killing some of the people who are responsible for it, but also responsible for keeping it safe or contained. I say that this is very much a layman's question, I realise, but these are the sorts of things that we consider when we're not experts.
No, it's an excellent question, and you're right. I mean, I think when they've got guards there now, at least it's safe. And I think the worry we have is in the chaos of war and in the chaos of the aftermath of war, will those guards remain? And we saw at the collapse of the Soviet Union how nuclear material went sort of AWOL, missing in action, and we end up not knowing where it all is and being very worried about its sale on illegal markets, etc., and also for the safety of people in the vicinity. So, you know, keeping guard is terribly important, and also having a plan to deal with it in the immediate aftermath of war is vital, and that really worries me. What are the contingency plans? Who's going in there? I know there's been a lot of talk about it, and probably, you know, the US and Israel don't want to say, but we do need to know there is a plan, right? Because what we saw after Iraq in 2003 is that there was no plan for this.
Yeah, they're important questions and concerns, aren't they? Thank you for joining us. Really appreciate your insight, Dr. Patricia Lewis, who's a nuclear physicist and former director of Chatham House's International Security Programme.
Let us get a quick preview of drama on Radio 4 this weekend.
Story of America on BBC Radio 4.
Nobody knows the trouble I've seen.
A music-fueled reimagining of Walter White's novel about Black American identity.
Everything's changing. Who we really are must not be forgotten.
Flight on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
I marvelled at the toughness of fibre which made my people able to live in the midst of such injustice.
Starts on Sunday at 3.
Now with news of better weather that we'll enjoy while we can, at least. Here's Sarah Keith-Lucas. Morning.
Morning, Anna. Yes, it's the spring equinox today, and it's certainly going to feel quite spring-like out there. Through today and into the weekend too, we've got high pressure dominating things, so not completely dry into the weekend, but most of us are going to see a good deal of dry weather. Some spring sunshine around, but also some mist and some fog too, and that's certainly what we've got this morning. Particularly across parts of eastern England, through the Midlands, northeast England and southeast Scotland, as well as Northern Ireland too. So you may well be waking up to some pretty poor visibility, murky conditions. The fog will gradually lift from most regions, but it will linger for quite a bit of the day, I think, for some prone spots like the Vale of York, for instance. Away from these areas, though, the mist and fog is fairly widespread in places, but only patchy. So the patchy areas will just clear away gradually, and then we'll see some longer spells of sunshine. Light winds too, so it will feel pleasant with those light winds and spring sunshine. Temperatures for most of us are going to be around 13 to 15 degrees, but for places like northeast Scotland and Northern Ireland, we could get up to about 18 or even 19, possibly the warmest day of the year so far there. And then heading through tonight, the theme continues. It's still dry with light winds, and a bit like last night, we'll see more mist and fog patches forming. Heading into tomorrow morning, then a bit of a murky and chilly start to the day once again, but the mist and fog should clear away tomorrow a bit quicker than it will today. So again, some sunshine, bit of cloud moving into the northwest on Saturday with the odd spot of light rain. That sets us up for something a little more unsettled as we head into next week, but certainly the next few days generally fairly spring-like and dry.
That's more like it, Sarah. Thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Today with Anna Foster in Salford, Simon Jack in London.
Good morning, it's 7 o'clock on Friday, the 20th of March. The headlines this morning: international oil and gas prices have slipped back overnight despite fresh Iranian attacks on energy producers in the Gulf. The family of a sixth former who died in the meningitis outbreak in Kent have joined calls for the national vaccination programme to be expanded. And from this weekend, getting into a football match without a ticket will be a criminal offence in England and Wales.
Also in the next hour, we have a special report from the Iranian border. As the Persian New Year dawns, families fleeing, their future uncertain.
Children are waking up to the sound of missiles. Filled with fear, families are leaving their homes just to survive. I'm absolutely heartbroken by what is happening in Iran.
And is it finally nearly lift off the Artemis moon mission? We will get the latest on what's happening at Cape Canaveral. BBC News is read by Lisa Costello.
Explosions have been heard in Tehran overnight as Iranians mark Nowruz, the Persian New Year. The Israeli military said it was carrying out another wave of airstrikes targeting infrastructure used by the Iranian regime. Energy prices have fallen back slightly after Israel promised to stop attacking Iranian gas fields, and European nations offered help to secure passage for ships through the Strait of Hormuz. From Jerusalem, our Middle East correspondent Yolan Nell reports.
There have been more heavy explosions reported in Tehran amid new Israeli strikes after Iran launched rounds of missiles at Jerusalem overnight. The loud thuds of interceptions were repeatedly heard overhead here. Earlier, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had told journalists that Iran was now decimated and unable to enrich uranium or manufacture ballistic missiles. This week, as Iran retaliated for Israel's strike on its vast South Pass gas field, global energy prices soared, but they've now begun to fall back with Israel's pledge to refrain from similar strikes and US plans to boost oil output. There was also a joint statement yesterday in which the UK, France, Japan and others expressed what they said was their readiness to contribute to appropriate efforts to ensure safe passage through the Strait of Hormuz.
In Kuwait, state media is reporting that an oil refinery has been hit by drones. Qatar's energy minister says Iranian strikes on its Ras Laffan gas facility will take up to 5 years to repair, as Azadeh Mashiri reports from Dubai.
Emergency crews battled a fire at the Mina Al Ahmadi refinery, and some units have been forced to shut down, according to Kuwait's state news agency. This is the nightmare scenario Gulf countries had hoped to avoid, their energy infrastructure becoming a repeated target in the war. After Israel's strikes on Iran's South Pars facility, Iran has retaliated, with Gulf countries on the front line of its fury. Qatar is still surveying extensive damage at Ras Laffan, a major liquefied natural gas field. Meanwhile, the UAE announced it had dismantled what it called a terrorist network funded by Hezbollah and Iran in the country. The war shows no sign of abating, even as countries across the Gulf mark Eid al-Fitr, the end of the holy month of Ramadan. Venezuela's interim president, Delcy Rodriguez, has replaced the country's senior military commanders a day after she brought in a new defence minister. It's the latest change at the top of the Venezuelan establishment since the US military captured the former leader, Nicolas Maduro, in January. Ms. Rodriguez, who'd been Mr. Maduro's vice president, has been cooperating with President Trump ever since. The father of a sixth form student who died in the meningitis outbreak in Kent has joined calls for the national vaccination programme to be extended to teenagers and young adults. Michael Kenny said his family's devastation was immeasurable after the death of his 18-year-old daughter, Juliet. There are now 27 suspected or confirmed cases of meningitis in the outbreak. Nick Johnson reports.
Juliet Kenny's father, Michael, said his daughter's impact on this world must be lasting change, and that now is the time to ensure families are safe from the impact of meningitis B. The MenB vaccine has been offered on the NHS to babies and young children since 2015. The charity Meningitis Research Foundation said its calls for the immunisation to be offered to all at-risk groups at the time was not taken forward, as it was judged not to be cost-effective. Speaking on a visit to the University of Kent, the Health Secretary Wes Streeting said he'd asked the government's independent advisers on vaccinations to revisit their recommendation.
Attending a football match in England and Wales without a ticket will become a criminal offence under new laws that come into force ahead of this weekend's Carabao Cup final at Wembley. Offenders will face a banning order of up to 5 years, as well as a fine of up to £1,000. Our sports editor Dan Roan has the details.
The new act is designed to clamp down on tailgating, where supporters force their way through turnstiles by staying closely behind legitimate ticket holders. It will also be illegal to knowingly use forged tickets, passes and accreditation documents, or by posing as a member of staff. Until now, there have been no specific legal penalties for unauthorised entry to a match, with supporters who are caught doing so tending to be ejected without any further punishment. The legislation has been introduced as a result of the serious disorder that marred the Euros final at Wembley in July 2021, when thousands of fans forced their way into the stadium. An FA-commissioned report found that sanctions on breaking into stadiums were weak and that tailgating should become a criminal offence.
The government is facing a new challenge to its immigration policies from some of its own MPs. They intend to force a vote on plans to double the length of time it takes for migrants to gain permanent residency rights, in most cases to 10 years. The Home Office has said primary legislation isn't required and it intends to implement the changes without a vote in Parliament. The Labour backbencher, Tony Vaughan, has sent a letter signed by 100 colleagues to the Home Secretary expressing opposition. The leader of the Green Party of England and Wales, Zach Polanski, has said becoming Prime Minister is definitely on his mind. But Mr. Polanski told Political Thinking with Nick Robinson that his immediate ambition was to have enough MPs to hold the balance of power after the next general election. Our political correspondent Harry Farley reports.
Before the last election, the Greens had only ever had one MP. Now they have five. But Zach Polanski's rising popularity has raised expectations about what the party could achieve. He admitted that because he kept being asked about it, becoming Prime Minister was now on his mind. And he said his previous target of 30 to 40 MPs he thought the Greens could win at the next election now felt under-ambitious. The immediate goal for the Greens was, Mr. Polanski said, to win enough MPs to hold the balance of power in a possible hung parliament.
People living in parts of northern Australia have been told to take shelter after a cyclone came ashore in Cape York with winds gusting at more than 130 miles an hour. The Premier of Queensland warned that tropical cyclone Narelle could be the worst in living memory.
NASA's huge moon rocket has started its four-mile journey back to the launch pad at Cape Canaveral in Florida after repairs for technical problems discovered last month. It's now hoped that the rocket will launch at the beginning of April. Our science editor, Rebecca Morell, has more.
Standing nearly 100 metres tall, NASA's mega moon rocket is being carried vertically on the back of a heavy-lifting crawler transporter vehicle. Travelling at around 1 mile an hour, but slower uphill and round corners, the journey to the launch pad at the Kennedy Space Center will take about 12 hours. This is the second time the rocket has been rolled out. It's had to undergo repairs after helium leaks were found last month. But NASA is confident the problem's been fixed and says the rocket's almost ready to go. The 10-day-long Artemis II mission will see four astronauts travel around the far side of the moon and back home again. The crew has now entered quarantine to prepare for the next launch window, which opens on the 1st of April.
The founder of Italy's right-wing Northern League party, Umberto Bossi, who pushed for independence for the wealthy north of the country, has died. He was 84. Gravel-voiced and famous for appearing in his vest while chewing a cigar, he spent much of his career criticising the central government as thieving Rome. Umberto Bossi stood down as Northern League leader in 2012 after he was accused of helping himself to party funds.
Thanks very much indeed, Lisa. It is 9 minutes past seven. The attacks on gas infrastructure in the Gulf marked a very significant escalation of hostilities, which sent energy prices soaring and stock markets around the world tumbling over the last 48 hours. An Israeli attack on the Iranian side of the huge gas field, South Pars, which supplies two-thirds of Iran's gas, prompted a retaliation on the Qatari side at Ras Laffan, which supplies 20% of the whole world's liquid natural gas. It drew a furious response from the Qatari Prime Minister and indeed from the US, who had avoided hitting energy infrastructure like this and were keen that Benjamin Netanyahu make clear that Israel acted alone in the original strike on the Iranian side. Last night, he did that. Now, gas prices have come down a little, as Israel has said that it will not initiate further attacks like that. But they're more than double the level they were before the conflict started. We can speak to John Wilkes, former British ambassador to Qatar, a distinguished fellow at the Atlantic Council. Good morning to you, John Wilkes. And it feels like these attacks crossed a line that the US had been quite keen not to cross.
Morning. Yes. I mean, this was an escalation that clearly could have gone even further towards escalation, towards attacks on water infrastructure. And the statements of Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu, I think, clearly indicate that they've decided that there's too much risk involved in that direction, although the damage has already been done to particularly Qatari infrastructure, which has had a significant impact on global gas markets, as we've seen.
Yeah, and it's quite interesting that, because I thought one of the reasons for some of the big swings we saw yesterday was people trying to figure out exactly how damaged this Ras Laffan plant was. And there was good news and bad news. I think 17% of its capacity is taken out, which is could have been worse, but it's going to take 5 years to fix.
That's true, though that should be set in the context of huge expansion plans for Qatar's LNG production and export. So we need to balance up the analysis of just how long this would take after this conflict to restore Qatari production and exports. But nevertheless, it's definitely a big hit. And it's clear, I think, that that Donald Trump decided that was not the way he wanted the campaign to go.
So fury in Qatar towards Iran, but also towards Israel?
So, yes, I think emotional reaction, you know, and public opinion, of course, sees this as an Israeli war in Qatar and the other Gulf states. That doesn't mean that there isn't even more anger towards Iran for hitting Qatar and the Gulf states as part of a strategy, basically, of hitting what is perceived as the weakest link. Now, that puts Qatar and the Gulf states in a you know, in a very dangerous position, and one that I think after this conflict they will want to get out of. That doesn't mean there's an alternative to the US as the main strategic partner, but I think there will be thinking about augmenting that with other partnerships. Qatar has a strong strategic partnership with the UK, and the UK Qatar Joint Typhoon Squadron has been operating successfully in defence of Qatar and indeed of other Gulf states since this campaign began. And I think it's important to recognize that there were measures in place beyond the relationship with the US to defend Qatar. And indeed, that's true for arrangements with other European countries like France. Mm. But the thing I think Qatar will focus on, and it already started on this, was its own defense production, usually in partnership, but including on its own territory. And I think with a focus on drone technologies and counter-drone technologies, I think that's where a vulnerability exists, and it clearly has to be filled. And other countries have done this. I was in Azerbaijan last week, who were attacked once by Iran and have these capabilities and were able to push back and seem to have done so successfully. And I think all Gulf countries, and maybe they'll need to work together to achieve this, will want to have that capability in future.
Obviously, Qatar's a huge exporter of liquid natural gas, which has become in many jurisdictions, many geographies, the swing bit of energy that you need to make up what a nation's energy needs are. Given we've seen the vulnerability here, and you've talked about maybe they will revamp their sort of security of these kind of sites, but I just wonder whether calls for de-escalation will just become louder as we've seen what the economic impacts of this. We're talking about demand destruction in some places in Asia at the moment.
Certainly calls for de-escalation, particularly from those countries themselves, will increase. And I think that's we're going to see that more widely in the international community. But if we step back and look at the actual campaign, Donald Trump is leaving himself the option to draw this campaign to a close sooner rather than later, although I think planning is to carry on for some weeks yet. It's clear that on the major metrics, progress is still being made. And of course, there is the question now of trying to remove a lot of the threat around the Straits of Hormuz to allow some form of naval protection to be implemented there. So I think there is, well, there are calls for de-escalation and certainly to avoid escalation towards hitting energy infrastructure and even more than that, water infrastructure. I think the balance of probabilities is that the campaign will continue while it continues to make progress.
Yeah, we'll just see how, obviously the duration of this, these hostilities is absolutely crucial in determining how big an economic shock these are. This is John Wilkes, former British ambassador to Qatar and distinguished fellow at the Atlantic Council. Thank you. And we will bring you a little sort of tale of the tape just after 8 o'clock, what the markets are doing. As I say, they've been in retreat a little bit, partly on those Israeli promises not to hit the kind of facility that they hit yesterday.
It's 7:15 now. Labour MPs who oppose the government's immigration reforms are threatening to force a symbolic vote against them in Parliament unless the Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, makes changes. She wants to double the amount of time it takes for migrants to get the right to remain in the UK from 5 years to 10 years. Earlier this week, Labour's former deputy leader, Angela Rayner, called that un-British and a breach of trust. Well, Tony Vaughan joins us, the Labour MP for Folkestone and Hythe. Good morning.
Morning, Anna.
You agree with Angela Rayner and you have other MPs who agree with you as well. What are the specific parts of these changes that, that you are not happy with?
Well, the idea of doubling or massively increasing the period for which somebody has to live here before they settle is a really important part of who belongs in our society. This is not about immigration control. It's about who belongs. And the Home Office's whole premise for these reforms is to say, well, you should take a lot longer if you're a care worker, for example, potentially 15 years to settle, because it is said that without reform we face a 10 billion drain on our public finances. But the evidence shows, and I read an IPPR analysis document yesterday showing that delaying settlement will not deliver that £10 billion in savings. Those are costs that would arise anyway, just a little bit later than at present. So the whole basis for this policy, in my view, is completely unfounded.
And presumably you're making those points to the leadership, and the fact that you're threatening to force a symbolic vote suggests that they're not listening to you.
Well, look, there isn't a vote as of right. There are ways potentially that we could seek a vote. I've said right from the point I led the Westminster Hall debate about this last month that that Parliament should be given a chance to have our say on it. But the fact that there's been some briefing from Number 10 to suggest that there may be changes is, of course, welcome. But I think that some transitional provisions that protect those already here, for example, won't fix the policy. It will put essentially a sticking plaster on a scheme that was flawed from the beginning.
Mm. But the fact that we're having this conversation about it, and the fact that you sort of brought it into the public domain, suggests that you're not getting back the ear from them that you would want.
Well, from what I can see, that the government are listening and engaging in the sense that they're allowing people who don't agree with these proposals to have their say. But ultimately, it will be for the government to decide how they respond. And it's for people like me who don't agree with these kinds of reforms to say that in a democracy, particularly if there isn't a kind of right to a vote as of right, which is the case in this situation. There may be ways of securing that. But I think it's really important that the government does listen to the concerns that have been expressed, because it's not just about the fact that their fundamental justification for this around the £10 billion doesn't add up. It's the fact that this will cost the Treasury. I mean, care workers and their dependents are net contributors for at least around 20 years of being in the UK. So if these reforms push people to leave, the Treasury loses that revenue now. And so if you just deter around 10 to 20% even of skilled migration, we lose billions to the Exchequer. So, and then there's a whole child poverty angle. I mean, there's...
Yeah, I mean, I just wanted to ask you, I mean, the government might well say and have said in the past that if they are to see off the challenge from parties like the Conservatives, parties like Reform, there is, for many people in this country, there is a real concern about migration, about the numbers, about the cost. And Labour will say if we don't tap into that, if we don't see that concern, then we will lose ground to other parties.
And I agree with that. But this policy is not about cutting in immigration. The government doesn't claim that it is about cutting immigration. It's about who belongs in our society. Now, that fundamental question, the answer that we have to that question as Labour politicians, tells a story about who we are as a Labour Party. And if we're telling the wrong story, a story about fear of hardship, of devaluing contributions of migrant workers, for example, then that is the wrong story. And we've got to get that right as politicians. But I do not accept that this earned settlement policy is necessary to control immigration. It's not about it's not about who comes in or out. It's about who belongs. And in any event, there's a whole load of questions about what our economy needs to staff our care homes. Care and health and social care in my constituency is one of the biggest sectors. There are a whole load of other sectors of the economy that need workers. And if people can get settlement in 5 years, as they can in the major EU economies, as they can in Canada and Australia, why would they come here? And that's not going to help the British public.
Tony Vaughan, thank you for joining us, the Labour MP for Folkestone and Hythe.
21 minutes past seven. We've just had half-year results from one of the UK's biggest pub groups. Fliss has got those. Fliss?
Yes, I do. So this is JD Wetherspoon, the chain that includes almost 800 pubs. It's reporting profits before tax of £26 million, down from £41 million for the same time last year. Now, of course, these results are for the 6 months to the end of January. They don't include any of the economic disruption coming from the conflict in Iran. I'm joined now by Satim Martin, founder and chair of Wetherspoons. Satim, good morning. What's behind the fall, and how concerned are you about the latest economic upheaval?
Our sales are pretty good. Sales are at a record. They were just under 5% up on the previous year. What's been well documented in the hospitality industry is a huge increase in government imposed costs. So that's really what's responsible for the reduction in profits. So you can see we're going along okay. We're making a buck. Like the industry as a whole, heavily impacted by the great increase in costs.
I want to get on to the current situation, but I just, on that question of making a buck and how much of a buck the government's taking, the government has announced a 15% discount, a two-year freeze to pubs' business rates, and a review of how valuations for business rates are calculated. So you are getting help in your sector.
There's a lot of smoke and mirrors in this sort of stuff. Our costs, employment and NIC went up by 1.2 million a week in April of last year, and it's going up again by about half that level. So the stuff about business rates is neither here nor there in the great scheme of things. 40% of every pint you buy in a pub, that's not just a Wetherspoon pub or a meal, goes to the government in taxes of one type or another. And it's gone up a lot for most companies over the years. Mm-hmm. And in effect, it's much, much cheaper now to have dinner parties, party on the beach, drink at home. And that's what the successive governments appear to be encouraging, okay, which is not very good for pubs or employment or tax, because government loses tax if you have a dinner party.
Talk to me then about the current situation. How concerned are you about the latest economic upheaval?
It's never good news. I think the lesson from the 1970s is that when energy prices go up, everyone becomes poorer apart from oil producers. So customers will become poorer because they'll have to pay more for their energy. And pubs' direct costs and suppliers' direct costs will increase. So the one thing that a society like Britain depends on is a reasonable supply of reasonably priced energy. And so it's not good news when the prices go up for economics.
Do you expect that for your business you're going to have to hike prices?
I've always found that it's got very little appeal for customers to tell them over the radio that you're going to stick your prices up.
But will you?
So I'm going to keep the inscrutable face of a sphinx in reply to that question.
But you've talked about energy bills going up, staffing costs going up, taxes going up. I mean, you know, it seems likely, doesn't it, that your costs are going to keep rising?
Well, if you look at the industry as a whole and retail as a whole, prices will go up. Talking about Wetherspoon, we've got a reputation for not putting them up very much, and we'll continue to try to be competitive.
So, Tim Martin, thank you very much indeed. And some new data just out, by the way. Public sector borrowing was £14.3 billion in February. That was £2.2 billion more than February last year, the second highest borrowing for February since monthly records began.
Thank you, Bliss. Just coming round to 7:25, NASA's Artemis mission to the moon is getting back on track. Once again, the crew capsule and its huge launch rocket rolling back out to the launch pad at Cape Canaveral in Florida. So perhaps it's time, tentatively, maybe, to get excited again. Here is a reminder of the extraordinary nature of that mission.
We're going to be going into an orbit almost right away that is 40,000 miles, like a fifth of the way to the moon, just in and of itself. We will have the Earth out the window as a single ball, something none of us have seen. And then we're going to travel 250,000 miles away.
Yeah, Rebecca Morel is our science editor. Morning, Rebecca.
Morning.
Remind us what went wrong, which sounds terribly dramatic, but what have the hiccups been so far?
Yeah, this is the second time the rocket's been rolled out to the pad. The first was back in January, and the rocket's had a few technical problems. First of all, hydrogen leaks during a fueling test. Hydrogen's one of the types of fuel it uses, and that was actually fixed at the launch pad. But later it had helium leaks, which meant the rocket had to be taken back to the vehicle assembly building, which is essentially a huge rocket hangar at the Kennedy Space Center, to be repaired. And engineers are really confident that they have fixed this. So the rocket is rolling back out to the launch pad today. It's about 3 hours into its 12-hour journey. I mean, this thing is huge. It's nearly 100 metres tall. It weighs 2,500 tonnes. So it's being carried on top of a vehicle called a crawler transporter. It's being carried vertically, so it can reach top speeds of about 1 mile an hour while it's being carried along, much slower going uphill and round corners. So the whole 4 mile journey takes about 12 hours in total. But once it's there, engineers will complete the final general sort of checks and tests, but they really want to get this rocket launched at the start of April. And the earliest date for a launch window to open is actually the 1st of April. And the astronauts have entered into quarantine now, so to prepare for the mission, so, you know, limiting their exposure to bugs and viruses, so they're in peak health for their 10-day mission.
Yeah, I think we're all jealous of anybody who's in peak health at the moment. And just, Rebecca, I know, I feel like I need it myself this morning. And one of the reasons that this is so hotly anticipated is what it will teach us about the moon that we don't already know, but also the potential of actually us having a base on the moon at some point, putting us closer to the rest of space.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, remember, this is the first time any humans have been to the moon in more than 50 years. And these astronauts will be flying around the far side of the moon. So they're not going into orbit around it. They're going to go around the back of the moon and come back to Earth again. But this launch is actually, this mission is paving the way for a future lunar landing and then a future moon base, because the difference between the Artemis missions and the Apollo missions that NASA wants to sort of build a sustained presence on the moon, to have astronauts living and working there, and they're not the only ones. China are wanting to do the same. I mean, China are aiming to get astronauts down to the lunar surface by 2030, and they're making very steady progress indeed. So the race is really on to get to the moon. I mean, and that is why NASA is under pressure to launch this mission. I mean, they've been saying for the last 2 years Artemis 2 will launch by the end of April 2026, so they really want to get this rocket up.
Yeah, that window narrowing, isn't it? Thanks, Rebecca Morell there, our science editor.
28 minutes past seven, we get some sports news, and Mike is here. I know you want to talk about football, but of the many impacts that are happening from the hostilities around Iran, cricket is being affected.
It's a big story, this, isn't it? Yeah, you mentioned this when I got in earlier. The Duke's cricket ball used across the English summer in both county championship and the test matches, the England senior team this summer, a big delay on them getting over from the Middle East. A big shipment was due, but is being held up. So as a consequence, Duke's, the manufacturer, saying that they have only about 50% of the balls that they need for the start of the English county championship.
Surely there's a strategic cricket ball reserve we can release.
Is there somewhere? Well, I wonder if even Donald Trump should weigh in on this. And he seems to be...
Sorry to distract you.
Yeah, well... we shall see. The county championship season starts 2 weeks today. So race against time to get those cricket balls in time for the start of the summer. But yes, we are going to talk football now, Simon, because we were reflecting yesterday on two English clubs reaching the quarterfinals of the Champions League. Well, now we know that two Premier League sides have also reached the quarterfinals of the Europa League as well. Aston Villa and Nottingham Forest are both through to the last eight after victories last night. Villa will play Bologna in the next round, whilst Forest will face Porto. Crystal Palace are also through to the quarterfinals of the Conference League. They will now meet Fiorentina. Meanwhile, if they haven't been told the news already, there will be several England footballers nervously looking at their phones this morning, waiting to find out whether they have made Thomas Tuchel's final squad before he names the players he will take to the World Cup in North America this summer. That squad being announced later today, and correspondent John Murray will be there to hear it first. He joins us now. Morning, John.
Yes, good morning.
So this is it. 83 days to go until the World Cup starts in June. And this squad is for a couple of friendlies, isn't it, at the end of the month?
That's right, yes, against Uruguay and Japan. And I think, Mike, if you are fit and have ambitions of going to the World Cup with England and you're not in this squad, that is probably it. Particularly since this could be a larger than normal squad that Thomas Tuchel names, because it's for those two friendly matches, because in these matches Thomas Tuchel will be able to make more substitutions than he has done in the recent qualifiers, and also because it's at this demanding time of the season for many of the clubs. So they'll have a couple of months, but I think if you're not in today, then you are struggling to be on the plane.
So give us the headlines then, John. Well, what are the big calls you're expecting Tuchel to make?
Well, you could go almost anywhere with this, but this season Thomas Tuchel's not called up anyone who's been playing for Manchester United, but they've had an upturn in fortunes, and I think that means that Harry Maguire, Luke Shaw and Kobbie Mainoo as well are back in contention. I think Trent Alexander-Arnold is an interesting one, settling in now at Real Madrid. He's not been picked by Tuchel this season. He's had injuries as well. We'll have to see if his Real Madrid teammate Jude Bellingham is fit to be included, because he's only just come back from a hamstring injury. And injuries have also prevented Cole Palmer from being available for England this season. Phil Foden's another one. I think he's not absolutely certain of his place in the World Cup squad. And another name as well, Harvey Barnes of Newcastle. He recently turned down the chance of switching his allegiance to Scotland. I wonder if that means he's back in for England.
And Harry Kane, John, of course, the captain, will lead the line for England. But are we any closer to knowing what would happen if Kane is injured?
Yeah, close call, I would say, as to who would be the first choice should anything happen to Harry Kane. Between Ollie Watkins, Danny Welbeck and the Dominics, Calvert-Lewin and Solanke. And I think, again, of those, who misses out today has got a lot to do to be on the plane.
And just briefly, John, 20 years ago, Sven-Göran Eriksson made what at the time felt a really big call when he took 17-year-old Theo Walcott to the World Cup in 2006 in Germany. A few rumours, a few whispers that, well, would Arsenal's 16-year-old starlet Max Dowman be in line for a similar shock inclusion?
Yes, I thought you might mention him, the 16-year-old, and the thing is, there's a lot of competition in the area where Max Dowman plays for Arsenal. I mentioned Cole Palmer, for example. I think it's more likely that Max Dowman would be allowed to continue his progress with the younger age group England's squads. But he is, as everyone knows now, a precocious talent. And at the very least today, we'll find out what Thomas Tuchel's making of his rapid rise.
What time's the squad out, John?
It is at 11 o'clock, it is named this morning.
Right
at Wembley.
You will be across it at Wembley for us, and you'll be able to read it in full once it is out on the BBC Sport website.
Thank you, Mike.
Hello, I'm Angela Scanlon, and I want to tell you about a brand new podcast, The Apprentice Unfinished Business.
You're fired.
Each week, straight after Lord Sugar's famous pointy finger has done its thing, I'll be joined by the fired candidates and there'll be special guests along for the ride.
You have somebody with a maths degree who cannot do 8 times 1.5.
We put 50p in each. It rounds up to 20 quid.
No, a tenner?
This is why I'll be bad on The Apprentice.
Is that a tenner?
The Apprentice Unfinished Business. Watch on iPlayer, listen on BBC Sounds.
Quick look at the weather this morning. Areas of mist and fog will be slow to clear, particularly in eastern England. Plenty of warm sunshine otherwise. You're listening to Today with Anna Foster in Salford, Simon Jack in London and Lisa Costello at 26 minutes to 8 has a summary of the news.
Israel has been hitting Tehran with airstrikes as Iranians mark Nowruz, the Persian New Year. Iran launched rounds of missiles at Jerusalem overnight, but there's been a slight fall in oil and gas prices. Last night, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said that his country would hold off on any further attacks on a key Iranian gas field. The UK, other European nations, Canada and Japan have offered to help secure passage for ships through the Strait of Hormuz. A number of Gulf countries are again coming under attack from drones and missiles fired by Iran. In Kuwait, state media is reporting that an oil refinery has been hit by drones. Figures released in the last half hour show public borrowing reached more than £14 billion last month. That's higher than economists had forecast. Venezuela's interim president, Delcy Rodriguez, has replaced the country's senior military commanders. She's been cooperating with President Trump ever since the US military captured the former leader Nicolas Maduro in January. The father of an 18-year-old girl who died in the meningitis B outbreak in Kent has joined calls for the expansion of the national vaccination programme to teenagers and young adults. Michael Kenny said his daughter Juliet's impact on this world must be lasting change. The government is facing a new challenge to its immigration policies from some of its own MPs. They intend to force a vote on plans to double the length of time it takes for migrants to gain permanent residency rights, in most cases to 10 years. The Home Office has said primary legislation isn't required and it intends to implement the changes without a vote in Parliament. NASA's huge moon rocket has started its four-mile journey to the launch pad in Florida after repairs. It's now hoped that the rocket, which is almost 100 metres tall, will take four astronauts around the moon at the beginning of next month for the Artemis II mission.
Thank you, Lisa. It's 24 minutes to eight. As the war rages in Iran, millions of people, both there and around the world, are marking Nowruz, the Persian New Year. It is traditionally a moment of light, lots of lights and of hope. But this year will be particularly difficult, both for Iranians inside and outside the country. Dan Johnson has been speaking to some who've recently crossed the border from Iran into Turkey.
A centuries-old celebration this year has a very different soundtrack. In the corner of a restaurant in Van, the closest city to the border, Ali Reza Mulli Hosseini plays the daf, a traditional Persian drum. So many lives have been upended, but after crossing to Turkey, Ali Reza is reproducing the familiar sounds of home.
In Iranian culture, sadness and happiness often go hand in hand. Iranians haven't been able to speak out or protest freely, and that's what led us here. War is never a good thing, not for Iran, not for any nation. Children are waking up to the sound of missiles, filled with fear. Families are leaving their homes just to survive. I'm absolutely heartbroken by what is happening in Iran.
The New Year's welcomed with hope of fresh beginnings. In the lobby of one of the hotels sheltering displaced Iranians, Anita Mohammed Pana approaches the table laid with candles and the Haftsin display, seven items symbolising health and renewal.
Nowruz is not being celebrated by anyone, but we hold on to the hope of freedom.
Anita, 24 years old, left Iran last summer, but now, when families are supposed to be coming together, just keeping in contact is difficult.
For days, I have no news from anyone. My sister gave birth and we didn't even get to talk. For those of us who left the country, our only comfort was being able to speak to our families over the internet.
Every day, more people take to the road and leave Iran. But at the border crossing, high in the snowy mountains, many still speak quietly for fear of reprisals.
There is no Nowruz this year. Many people are mourning because 2 months before the killing of people.
Will you celebrate at all?
No. We want people of the world to understand my country. Very hard, very.
We can't celebrate Nowruz this year unless we are sure of the fall of the regime and that the families of the fallen can celebrate with us.
But there are people heading the other way, carrying opposing views. Listen to this man we met who supports the regime.
America and Israel should keep their hands off Iran. We just came to Turkey for 3 days. Now we have Nowruz, so we came to buy things and we're going back. Long live Iran forever.
Back in the city, Ali Reza has a message of healing and optimism.
This celebration can be a time of renewal, but doing so with a thoughtful eye on our past.
But that history makes new beginnings difficult and lasting peace even harder.
Yeah, the sound of a very different Nowruz celebration this year. So while questions about whether and how President Trump is looking to end his military operations, those questions getting louder all the time, what would it take for Iran to cease its own missile volleys and its blocking of the Strait of Hormuz? Well, Dr. Dina Isfandiari is the Middle East lead at Bloomberg Geoeconomics, and I asked her what might persuade Tehran to stop its bombing campaign.
I'm afraid that on this, I don't have very much good news. I think that from Iran's perspective, the only thing that would make them stop the war is if they felt secure enough to stop imposing a cost on the international community. The reason is this war for them is about survival. It's about the Islamic Republic staying in place. And they're worried that if they don't exact enough of a cost on the global economy, on the US, on Israel, on American regional allies, they will just stop the war now, regroup, and come back and reattack in 6 months' time. So they really want to make sure that everybody feels enough of a pain that they won't come back. And so that makes them a very dangerous warring party right now.
And it does appear that Iran has the ability to continue those attacks, as you say, for as long as it wants to.
Absolutely, at least for the foreseeable future. What Iran wanted out of another potential war with the United States is exactly what's happening right now. They wanted it to turn into a war of attrition, where they would drag American forces and the American military might into the region and get it bogged down into the region. Iran is basically on the right side of what we call the cost curve when it comes to its military arsenal. It has the ability to have a really high impact in places like the Strait of Hormuz with very, very cheap munitions, sometimes not even munitions. All it needs is a little wooden boat with a bomb or an explosive on it. So from Iran's perspective, this is easy to sustain for a really long time. And it really is everyone's worst case scenario in terms of the global economy. Of course, there's a cost to Iran, but at the moment, it's a cost it's willing to bear.
And Dina, who is making those decisions in Tehran now? Because as we know, as we've seen, the US and Israeli strategy is to try and kill as many of the key leaders as possible. So who is in charge? Who is deciding what the next steps for Iran will be?
Well, they've elected a new supreme leader. So Mujtaba Khamenei at the moment is the one who's supposed to be making decisions, but he hasn't been seen in public. So it's unclear whether he's injured, whether he's capable of making those decisions or not. Ultimately, it doesn't matter. I think there is clearly a core group of individuals within the system, likely many of them close to the Revolutionary Guards, because we get a sense that the system is becoming more militaristic. These are the guys that are making the decisions right now. What's important to highlight is that the Islamic Republic has been preparing for this kind of attack, certainly since the war in June, but even before that. And so it was ready to have these kind of decapitation strikes, and it has layers and layers of other elites that will move their way up through the system in order to fill these posts relatively quickly. The risk, though, is that you end up putting in place people that are more extremist, more hardline, and that makes ending the war even harder.
Dr. Dina Esfandiary, thank you for joining us.
Sorry, beg your pardon, Anna, my turn, I beg your pardon. Now, let us return to the events in Iran. The price of oil and gas, of course, has been rocketing, and it is very pervasive. It gets into pretty much everything, petrol, obviously, heating, but also plastic, fertilisers, food, and those inflationary forces affect interest rates, and so the price... I beg your pardon. Sorry, I got my eye off the ball. We're going to talk to a little bit about a taster we've got for this weekend. My apologies. A little treat, an interview with the 91-year-old legend of British letters, Alan Bennett. His new collection of diaries, Enough Said, published this week, finds him navigating royal receptions at Windsor, the comforts and confusions of old age, and the gentle absurdities of being looked after at home, all with that unmistakable mix of dry Yorkshire humour and quiet tenderness. Alan Bennett sat down with James Naughtie for an exclusive broadcast interview. We'll bring you that conversation on tomorrow's programme, but thought we would give you a taster now. Alan Bennett reflects with Jim on those tumultuous years of Brexit, COVID, and the death of the Queen, and on the people he misses, including the actress Dame Maggie Smith, whose absence he still feels keenly.
I miss her now all the time. You could rely on her not taking the same line as anybody else. She could make you laugh and cry almost in the same sentence. It was always there, the sadness as well as the jokes.
The death of the Queen is obviously one of the prime events, public events, in this period of your diaries. And you've got terribly touching stories which you've told in the diaries about your father, who wasn't a demonstrative man, going out to see the young Princess Elizabeth coming to Leeds and taking off his trilby.
Mm. My dad suddenly took off his hat, and this was so unlike him, I mean, because it was a gesture and it was an acknowledgement of something that he'd never given any indication of caring about at all. It nearly made me cry. It was so, upsetting.
And I think you say that you realise that you've got a similar feeling. You know, you don't sit at home and think about the monarchy or anything else like most people, but you do have something that that stirs you.
I know, in the last resort, I'm English and
it's there.
And it's there, yes.
And that interview with Alan Bennett is on tomorrow morning, just after 8 o'clock.
It is 14 minutes to 8 now. It's time for Thought for the Day. And the speaker this morning is Catherine Pepinster, Catholic commentator. Good morning.
Good morning, Anna. This morning, the Archbishop of Canterbury, Sarah Mullally, is continuing her pilgrimage from London to Canterbury as preparation for her installation service next week. It's a walk that reflects how important pilgrimage is in Christian and other religious traditions. Countless people have found that a pilgrimage to a sacred site is transformational, not just for the destination, but the journey too. The steadiness of walking, combined with prayer and companionable silence with fellow believers, make it so different from the normal fast pace of everyday life. Then there are the stopping points with opportunities for shared meals and conversation. They matter too. Nowadays, as viewers have seen on series of BBC One's Pilgrimage, these journeys can also make a difference to the lives of people who are not such firm believers. But however much people might relish how different a pilgrimage is from their normal lives, it's also a moment to think about those lives. And then there are times when the world impinges on pilgrimage in the most dramatic way. This Lent, for example, pilgrims wanting to visit one of the Holy Land's special Christian places can't do so. The Church of the Holy Sepulchre, believed to be the site of Jesus' burial after his crucifixion, has been closed. The Israeli Foreign Ministry has reported that an Iranian missile fired during the current conflict between Israel, Iran and the United States fell close to the old city of Jerusalem and the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, and it will remain closed until the end of the war. The Greek Orthodox, Armenian and Roman Catholic churches that run it are appealing for it to be open for pilgrims in the run-up to Easter, but it's looking unlikely. But this is not a moment for despair, as the example of Canterbury, the very place that Sarah Mullally is travelling to, shows. The Archbishop is walking in the footsteps of countless pilgrims, drawn there because of the martyrdom of Thomas Becket, another Archbishop of Canterbury, killed in 1170 by knights working for Henry II. But the shrine to Becket, made a saint 3 years after his death, was later destroyed during the Reformation by Henry VIII and his henchman Thomas Cromwell, who denounced shrines, relics and pilgrimages as Catholic superstition. Nor did Henry want the story of another King Henry, challenged by a Catholic prelate, remembered as he broke away from Rome. Yet in recent times, Canterbury has once again become a place of pilgrimage for Anglicans and Catholics alike. As Sarah Mullally arrives in Canterbury, she will not only be visiting a place dedicated to Becket's memory and to God, but a place that symbolises how seemingly intractable division can be overcome.
That was Thought for the Day with Catherine Pepinster, Catholic commentator. It's 10 to 8.
What impact will the war on Iran have here in the economy of the UK? The price of oil and gas, remember, is very pervasive. It gets into everything. Petrol, obviously, heating, plastics, fertiliser, food. And those collective inflationary forces affect interest rates. And so the price of loans and mortgages are affected. We've already seen lenders hike mortgage rates and withdraw hundreds of mortgage products. Yesterday, the Bank of England chose to leave rates unchanged. 3 weeks ago, most were betting they would cut them. But the Governor, Andrew Bailey, talked about needing to assess this, in his words, new shock to the economy. So how big a shock are we talking about and how will it affect all of us? So Charlie Bean is a former member of the Monetary Policy Committee and Lord Stuart Rose, former chairman of ASDA and Ocado, both on the line. Good morning to you both. Can I start with you, Charlie Bean? What did you make of the government's comments yesterday? How much of a shock to the economy are we talking about?
Well, the energy price shock itself is clearly very significant. And I think what we've
been seeing in recent days, and it was reinforced by the market movements yesterday, is market participants realizing that the conflict is likely to last longer and the impact on global energy supplies last longer, and therefore the potential impact on our economies will be more profound. In terms of the channels of how that affects the economy, you have to remember there's really two effects. There's a direct effect on prices, because energy costs are higher, that raises household utility bills. It also raises production costs for businesses. So that's pushing prices up, and will probably add about a percentage point or more to inflation in the second half of this year. But also the higher prices tend to dampen demand because they reduce people's real incomes and real wealth. So activity falls. And for central banks, they're faced with a difficult balancing act, because you have one force which is saying you need to tighten policy, and on the other hand, another force which is saying loosen.
Mm-hmm.
And the message that we saw from the Bank of England, and indeed from other central banks who've been taking decisions in the past couple of days, is that they're monitoring things closely, and they're standing ready to act.
Mm.
And in particular, they're vigilant to see if there's so-called second-round effects happening. So you can, so
and those second round effects would include things like, for example, people starting to ask for more money when it comes to wage demand.
Exactly.
Okay.
The central banks can't do anything about the energy price shock, but they can make sure that inflation doesn't get embedded, higher inflation get embedded in the system. Mm. So they're sending the signal that they stand ready to act. What they did, they weren't saying yesterday, is interest rates are going to rise.
Yes, you did say that you were getting ahead of ourselves, thinking there'll be a series of interest rate rises.
And I've seen some commentary suggesting, that was the message. That wasn't the message.
Okay.
The message was they will act if needed.
I'm going to come back to you about the recent borrowing figures we saw just out this morning, but let me turn to Lord Stuart Rose. Lord Rose, here we go again, a cost of living crisis, which for many never went away. Looks like it's in prospect again. Where do you see it pinching particularly?
Well, Simon, you know, my way of saying this is that oil and gas is to business what water is to life. So it will affect everything, as Charlie has just said. And it's a question for us now is how long will this go on for? And the longer it goes on for, the more painful we'll get. And I'm now thinking sort of beyond this and say to ourselves, well, what lesson can we learn? What is the bigger lesson? Because if you look back in the last 15 years, we've had the global financial crisis, we've had Brexit, we've had COVID, we've had the Ukraine war, we've had a terrible time with inflation. We just thought we might be getting back onto a level playing field. And here we are, we've now got this. And this says to me, for the UK, what are we doing to rethink the UK so that we can make it more insulated for the future and create ourselves a better platform for the future? Because there'll be another crisis at some point in time, and the government is not immune from it. And because we're nearly bust as a country financially, we can't afford to bail it out all the time.
Well, that's the interesting. What does the government do? Because the examples you just mentioned, COVID, Russia, I mean, in both of these, the government spent tens of billions of pounds intervening in that, whether it was for an energy price guarantee, whether it was for, paying people's wages during furlough. People, in a way, we've gotten used to government stepping in.
We can do that if we have got a vibrant economy and we are creating wealth. At the moment, we can't do it. So the only way we've been able to do it, and Charlie knows this better than I do, is by borrowing money. The problem is that we are reaching borrowing capacity and the cost of borrowing is going up. It's a nil-sum game. The government needs to get a grip about what it does to the UK economic balance sheet and say there are things we can afford and things we can't afford. And I'll go back onto my old bandwagon, which is we are spending too much money on welfare. We're spending too much money on quangos. We're spending too much money on things which are inefficiencies like the National Health Service and whatever else. And we've got to make some tough decisions. Mm. You can't have it both ways.
And you'd be advocating that whether we were in this position or not, just to give us.
Yes, and people will say, you know, I'm talking about austerity. I'm not talking about austerity. Okay. I'm talking about common sense and belt tightening.
Okay, let me just ask Charlie Bean. We've just had in the last hour figures showing that public sector borrowing came in at 14 billion in February. Now that's a big bump back to earth after a surplus in January, and it's the second highest on record. I just wonder, you almost feel a bit sorry for Rachel Reeves, because all the big things were actually going in the right direction. Interest rates were coming down, inflation was coming down, and that was having a beneficial effect on the public purse, which now looks as if it's going in the other direction.
Indeed. And the borrowing figures are a reminder that the UK's UK government's fiscal position is still quite precarious. Also, because interest rates have been rising in the past day or two, the cost of borrowing to the government is significantly higher than it was. And it's also significantly higher than in our peer countries across the channel, for instance. The Chancellor is quite constrained about what sort of support she might be able to offer on this occasion. You mentioned the energy price guarantee that was introduced after the invasion of Ukraine, when we saw a previous much larger energy price spike. There the support was over 2% of GDP, 40 billion or so. She doesn't have that room for manoeuvre this time. So if she does offer some support because the rise in energy prices is sustained into the winter, then she'll need to make it more targeted.
And a last word for you, Lord Rose. We're going to have to get used to more expensive food. Fertiliser goes into food, prices in the shops are going up, yes?
I'm afraid to say that if this goes on for much longer, inevitably there will be price rises, there will be inflation, as Charlie's pointed out.
Lord Stuart Rose and Sir Charlie Bean, thank you both.
Now, let's hear from Alex Forsyth with a word about this evening's Any Questions. Morning, Alex.
Hi, good morning, Anna. With all of the human and economic consequences of the Iran war to contemplate, we are in Eastleigh in Hampshire to try and gauge what people make of it all, or indeed what else they might want to talk about. Joining me there will be Dame Meg Hillier, Labour MP and Chair of the Commons Treasury Select Committee. Paul Holmes is a Conservative Shadow Minister for Housing, Communities and Local Government. Jess Brown Fuller is the Liberal Democrat spokesperson for Justice. And Peter Hitchens is a columnist for The Mail on Sunday. We'll be live at 8pm. Hope you can join us.
Thank you, Alex. Sarah, with some weather, looking good.
It is indeed, Simon. Yes, it's the spring equinox today, and we've got lots of spring-like sunshine in the forecast for the next few days, but not everywhere first thing this morning, because there's quite extensive fog, mist and low cloud around, particularly so for parts of the Midlands, Eastern England, Northeast England, and there's also some fog patches for Central Scotland and Northern Ireland too. But if you're waking up to the mist and murk, bear with the weather, because it will gradually brighten up through the day. So blue skies developing, fairly light winds for most of us too. It will just be a little breezier along the south coast today. And temperature-wise, getting up to around 13 to 16 degrees quite widely across the board, but parts of Northern Ireland and Northeast Scotland may see highs of 18 degrees, possibly the warmest day of the year so far there. And it looks like high pressure stays with us into the weekend, so expect a lot more dry weather on the cards. Some sunshine by day, but also mist and fog for the next few nights. Big range in temperature, daytime temperatures in the high teens, but overnight, some of us getting down below freezing.
Thank you, Sarah. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Simon Jack in London and Anna Foster in Salford.
Good morning. It's 8 o'clock on Friday, the 20th of March. The headlines. Oil and gas prices appear to have stabilised after the US and Israel promised no more attacks on Iran's gas fields. But Gulf energy producers have been again targeted by Iranian missiles and drones. The government borrowed more than £14 billion last month, the second highest February figure on record. And the family of a sixth former who died in the meningitis outbreak in Kent have joined calls for the vaccination programme to be expanded.
Coming up in the next hour of the programme, as the COVID inquiry finds the NHS only managed to cope thanks to the superhuman efforts of healthcare workers, we'll speak to a doctor who gave testimony about that harrowing experience.
They're no strangers to death. They are the intensive care unit. They look after some of the sickest patients in the hospital. But the scale of death was truly, truly astounding.
And?
A career spanning six decades, over 30 albums... And yet to the world, she's still just Mick Jagger's ex-girlfriend.
That's a new film looking at the life of the extraordinary Marianne Faithfull. We'll speak to the directors before 9 o'clock. Before that, the BBC News is read by Lisa Costello.
Explosions have been heard in Tehran as Iranians mark Nowruz, the Persian New Year. The Israeli military said it was carrying out another wave of airstrikes targeting infrastructure used by the Iranian regime. Energy prices have fallen back slightly after Israel promised to stop attacking Iranian gas fields, and European nations offered help to secure passage for ships through the Strait of Hormuz. From Jerusalem, our Middle East correspondent Yulan Nell reports.
There have been more heavy explosions reported in Tehran amid new Israeli strikes after Iran launched rounds of missiles at Jerusalem overnight. The loud thuds of interceptions were repeatedly heard overhead here. Earlier, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had told journalists that Iran was now decimated and unable to enrich uranium or manufacture ballistic missiles. This week, as Iran retaliated for Israel's strike on its vast South Pass gas field, global energy prices soared. But they've now begun to fall back with Israel's pledge to refrain from similar strikes and US plans to boost oil output. There was also a joint statement yesterday in which the UK, France, Japan and others expressed what they said was their readiness to contribute to appropriate efforts to ensure safe passage through the Strait of Hormuz.
Kuwait state media is reporting that an oil refinery has been hit by drones. Qatar's energy minister says Iranian strikes on its Ras Laffan gas facility will take up to 5 years to repair. Azadeh Moshiri reports from Dubai.
Emergency crews battled a fire at the Mina al-Ahmadi refinery, and some units have been forced to shut down, according to Kuwait state news agency. This is the nightmare scenario Gulf countries had hoped to avoid, their energy infrastructure becoming a repeated target in the war. After Israel's strikes on Iran's South Pars facility, Iran has retaliated, with Gulf countries on the front line of its fury. Qatar is still surveying extensive damage at Ras Laffan, a major liquefied natural gas field. Meanwhile, the UAE announced it had dismantled what it called a terrorist network funded by Hezbollah and Iran in the country. The war shows no sign of abating, even as countries across the Gulf mark Eid al-Fitr, the end of the holy month of Ramadan.
Figures released by the Office for National Statistics this morning show the government borrowed more than £14 billion last month. It's the second highest February figure since records began in 1993. Here's our business correspondent, Mark Ashdown.
The government spends more on funding public services and debt than it receives in taxes, so it borrows to make up the difference. The Office for National Statistics said that while tax receipts were up on the same month last year, that was outweighed by a rise in spending, including the later timing of some debt interest payments. January's £30 billion tax receipts were revised up by £1 billion, but there are warnings from analysts that rising energy costs remain a clear risk to public finances, which could widen the government's deficit. However, provisional estimates show that borrowing is currently £126 billion over the past 11 months, which is £12 billion less than the previous year and below the official forecast. The Treasury said its economic plan meant it was better prepared for a more volatile world, yet £1 in every £10 is still currently spent on debt interest, which ministers said needed to be addressed, so more could be spent on policing, schools and the NHS.
Labour MPs opposed to the government's immigration reforms are threatening to expose the party's divisions by forcing a symbolic vote in Parliament unless ministers back down. The Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, plans to double the length of time that it will take for migrants to gain indefinite leave to remain or permanent residency, in most cases to 10 years. She argues that the changes are necessary to restore trust in the immigration system and to tackle the consequences of high level of net migration in recent years. Here's our political correspondent, Ian Watson.
The Home Secretary's rule changes would apply not just to new arrivals, but also to migrants who are already in the UK. This was denounced as un-British and a breach of trust by Labour's former deputy leader, Angela Rayner, earlier this week. Ministers have since signalled their willingness to introduce transitional arrangements for some migrants, which might reduce the waiting time for permanent settlement from 10 years. But the Folkestone MP Tony Vaughan, who sent a letter signed by 100 colleagues to the Home Secretary expressing concerns, told this programme that the rule changes should be abandoned completely.
some transitional provisions that protect those already here, for example, won't fix the policy. It will put essentially a sticking plaster on a scheme that was flawed from the beginning.
The government's changes can be introduced without a vote in the Commons. Mr. Vaughan and fellow opponents plan to use parliamentary procedures to force a symbolic vote in the coming months, unless ministers back down.
The father of a sixth form student who died in the meningitis outbreak in Kent has joined calls for the national vaccination programme to be extended to teenagers and young adults. Michael Kenny said his family's devastation was immeasurable after the death of 18-year-old Juliet. There are now 27 suspected or confirmed cases of meningitis in the outbreak. Nick Johnson reports.
Juliet Kenny's father, Michael, said his daughter's impact on this world must be lasting change, and that now is the time to ensure families are safe from the impact of meningitis B. The MenB vaccine has been offered on the NHS to babies and young children since 2015. The charity Meningitis Research Foundation said its calls for the immunisation to be offered to all at-risk groups at the time was not taken forward, as it was judged not to be cost-effective. Speaking on a visit to the University of Kent, the Health Secretary Wes Streeting said he'd asked the government's independent advisers on vaccinations to revisit their recommendation.
Attending a football match in England and Wales without a ticket will become a criminal offence under new laws that come into force ahead of this weekend's Carabao Cup final at Wembley. Offenders will face a banning order of up to 5 years, as well as a fine of up to £1,000. Our sports editor Dan Roan has the details.
The new act is designed to clamp down on tailgating, where supporters force their way through turnstiles by staying closely behind legitimate ticket holders. It will also be illegal to knowingly use forged tickets, passes and accreditation documents, or by posing as a member of staff. Until now, there have been no specific legal penalties for unauthorised entry to a match, with supporters who are caught doing so tending to be ejected without any further punishment. The legislation has been introduced as a result of the serious disorder that marred the Euros final at Wembley in July 2021, when thousands of fans forced their way into the stadium. An FA-commissioned report found that sanctions on breaking into stadiums were weak and that tailgating should become a criminal offence.
The government says it will fund the clean-up of some of the worst illegal rubbish tips in England as part of its new Waste Crime Action Plan. Huge tips in Wigan, Sheffield and Lancashire are being assessed by the Environment Agency before work to clear them starts. Our Rural Affairs correspondent Jenny Kumar reports.
For the last year and a half, people in Bickershaw in Wigan have lived with the smells, vermin and fires caused by tons of illegal waste dumped next to their homes and primary school. The responsibility for clearing illegal tips lies with the landowner, not the Environment Agency or councils. But campaigners in Wigan questioned why officials couldn't step in. Now the government has announced it will pay to clear the site together with two others. The move is part of a new waste crime plan that will also give local authorities and the Environment Agency more powers and resources to stop the criminals. Residents in Bickershaw have welcomed the plan, but some have questioned whether it will be enough to bring those running illegal tips to justice.
The Natural History Museum in London has been named as the UK's most popular attraction for the first time. More than 7 million people visited last year, a new record. Fiona Lambden reports.
The Natural History Museum first opened its doors 145 years ago, founded by the scientist Sir Richard Owen. Out of its 80 million objects, Sophie the Stegosaurus, who lived 150 million years ago, is one of the stars. And it's hugely busy. Last year, the museum, which is free to visit, welcomed 7.1 million people. That's around 20,000 people a day, and up 13% on the previous year. The UK's second most popular attraction was the British Museum, with 6.4 million visits. Windsor Great Park was third, with 5 million.
Fiona Lambden reporting.
Thank you, Lisa. It's 10 minutes past eight. The war in Iran enters its fourth week tomorrow, having already found a grim rhythm of repeated daily attacks, but without any really visible signs of a military operation that's about to be completed. President Trump says it's ahead of schedule, and last night, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu claimed Iran can no longer enrich uranium or build ballistic missiles.
It's not bad, and it's going to be over with pretty soon. We've obliterated the Navy. We've obliterated their... just about everything there is to obliterate.
Despite the fake news that is unfortunately being spread since the start of the war 20 days ago, we are winning and Iran is being decimated.
But what Tehran does have and is using daily is the ability to hit the global economy where it hurts. Whether it's Qatar's natural gas facility or Dubai's airport, huge vital industries like energy and tourism are well within Iran's reach to disrupt at will. So what challenges does that cause when it comes to ending this war? Who has the power and control to make that decision to stop? Well, I've been speaking to Thomas Nides, who was US ambassador to Israel between 2021 and 2023. And I asked him, while conversations had clearly been had between those two countries about why this war should start, if he thought similarly comprehensive discussions had been had in advance about its end.
That is the billion-dollar question, right? I think, obviously in any war, it's a lot easier to start these things than to end them. And I think ultimately that decision is going to have to be up to Donald Trump. I mean, obviously the Israelis have a say, but obviously they need the Americans. So until the president has defined success, which, as you know, has been a bit evasive of what success looks like. The prime minister has talked about success as regime change, so has President Trump. There's been some discussion that it was really about the nuclear stockpile and getting that, ballistic missiles, Hezbollah. So I think they're going to have to get really clear here and define what success is and get this thing resolved once they've decided they've achieved their goals.
Do you think we're starting to see diverging goals now between the US and Israel and possibly even diverging strategies as well?
Well, listen, as someone who obviously sat in that situation room for many, many meetings on this topic and obviously knows the prime minister, has been very clear for a long time that Iran is the most serious problem in the Middle East. And I think he's not wrong. How to execute that has been the debate. But the prime minister has found a president who's willing to actually get more aggressive. But there's a reason why we didn't do this in the past, because as you pointed out at the beginning, starting these things is easy, certainly easier than ending them, and we're now facing that scenario.
And ending it becomes even harder now because presumably President Trump will choose the end point and will declare that as victory. But if Iran don't then stop, particularly the economic warfare that they've launched, then it becomes a lot more difficult, doesn't it?
Well, certainly. And listen, the Iranian success for the Iranians is survival. So, I mean, you know, when you get into a fight with people who have less to lose than you do, that's really complicated. And I think you're going to see that play out, is playing out in Iran. The leadership doesn't have much to, you know, right now their view of this is if we survive, we've won.
Yeah, it was interesting to see Donald Trump's response to the Israeli attack on the gas field. And in particular, it's notable that the president has tried to say, look, we're targeting the military. We're targeting the nuclear program. We're not targeting the people and their civilian infrastructure. But again, we seem to see a difference of opinion, perhaps a difference of strategy between the US and Israel.
Wars get complicated and you have a lot of different conflicting reasons why we're doing different activities. Listen, I don't think President Trump was focused necessarily on more action in Lebanon, right? In Beirut in particular. I think he was much more focused on the Iran threat, but the prime minister fundamentally believes, and not wrongly, if you live in the northern part of Israel, you certainly don't like being showered with ballistic missiles and missiles and drones. So he's using this opportunity to obviously do more, stomp out Hezbollah in Lebanon. So, you know, everyone's got their, everyone's got in these combat, everyone's got their objectives here. And I think you're seeing that play out in real time.
One question that keeps coming into my mind is how, and particularly when we see the economic squeeze, the impact really being felt on things like gas prices, for ordinary Americans filling up their cars. For how long can the president justify this war to them and tell them that it's a good thing, especially with the midterms looming?
These wars are never popular long term. And, you know, having been involved in Iraq and Afghanistan and even Libya, you know, they started out relatively popular, right? That because, you know, the presidents get out and explain to people why it's in their business, why they have short term suffering, but it's long term benefit. For a lot of reasons, that didn't happen here. The president, for secretive reasons, for reasons that he decided that he really wasn't going to spend the time communicating to the American people. So this war is already pretty unpopular now. Okay. And sadly, as you know, over time, it becomes less popular. For the exactly the reasons you talked about, economics, you know, cost money, God forbid soldiers get lost lives. And so the president will have to balance that out, short term and long term.
You mentioned places like Iraq, Libya, which you were involved in, which I've seen subsequently. How does this need to be different? You know, those problems are well documented about having a war, and then what happens afterwards is not what anybody wanted. What needs to be done to make sure that we don't end up with an Iraq or a Libya or something like that in the future?
I hope they have a plan, because unfortunately, again, I'm totally in favor of diminishing the ballistic missile in Iran and obviously obliterating for the second time, I guess, whatever that called, double obliteration, the nuclear ambitions of the Iranians. But I don't think we have yet to see, you know, the green shoots of regime change.
And just trying to, at this stage, and things change, they change every day, don't they? But trying to envisage at this stage a situation in which Iran decides to stop fighting back, attacking its Gulf neighbors, it's hard to imagine what that situation might look like. What might cause that?
I could see a scenario where they determine that they have, quote, stayed alive, meaning that they push back the Western powers, and that there's some sort of negotiation around opening the Straits of Hormuz, and maybe they get back to the negotiating table around the nuclear materials embedded in Iran. I think, listen, one thing is for sure, you've covered these for a long time. I've obviously been engaged. These do not last forever, and it certainly not at the pace it's operating right now. So I think ultimately, you know, people will potentially have to sue for peace.
Ambassador Knight, thanks for joining us. Thank you. Let's get the thoughts of Mark Urban, Sunday Times columnist and Newsnight's former diplomatic editor. Morning, Mark.
Good morning, Anna.
Well, where do you think the power is now, the control maybe over what's happening?
Well, I think if we look at the events of the last couple of days, it's pretty clear that the Iranians have been able to control the pace of escalation on this. Now, that may not necessarily stay that way, but that sequence of events where the Israelis bombed the gas field, Iran then hit back at Qatar's natural gas facilities and Saudi refineries, and then Trump jumped onto social media, trying to distance himself from it, although I think it's pretty clear that the US would have known in advance about that strike, and trying to say it won't happen again unless you carry on hitting at Qatar and other energy facilities. Well, what did the Iranians do? They didn't pause for thought. They then immediately, yesterday morning, struck the Yanbu refinery, which is on the other side of Saudi Arabia from the Gulf, the Red Sea coast, and where Saudi Arabia is trying to get a part of its oil exports out onto the world market through still. They hit a couple of refineries in Kuwait. And in other words, they've carried on sort of demonstrating that Trump has stepped back and that they can carry on hitting Gulf energy infrastructure. So they have shown at the moment that they have the hand on the accelerator, as it were. And similarly, it's interesting how we talk about the closure of the Strait of Hormuz. But of course, the Iranians can selectively let ships out. And there is information this morning of several tankers with oil that's believed to be bound for China are assembling, apparently, on their way out. So Iran can favour its friends and spite its Gulf neighbours by doing that to maintain economic pressure.
Do you think, Mark, that the US and Iran calculated that removing the figures right at the top of the Iranian regime, killing them as they have, would have a more detrimental effect on the military strategy than we've seen.
Anna, you said the US and Iran. I don't know whether you meant the US.
Apologies, US and Israel, yeah.
Yeah, I think, well, the Israelis had this experience back in late 2024 when they hit Hezbollah, the Lebanese movement that is very much a proxy of Iran, that when they killed its long-term and charismatic leader, Sheikh Nasrallah, it really did cause a great deal of trouble in the organization. And that, of course, was combined with those exploding pagers, which a lot of which were being carried by key commanders. So I think because of that, the Israelis overestimated the effect of decapitation. And the Iranians have had for some years now what's sometimes called the mosaic principle, which means that lots of different people have devolved authority to take action. And there's been an open debate among the experts about whether some of these strikes, for example, against some of the Gulf states like Oman that are friendlier towards Iran or indeed even against Turkey, might be just being carried out by commanders on their own initiative. So I don't think it has had the effect in terms of toppling the government. But now, of course, we have to see what effect it has in terms of any possible end game when eventually that comes into sight. Does it make it harder or easier for Iran to get a consensus about the terms under which it should stop?
Thank you, Mark. Mark Urban, Sunday Times columnist, Newsnight's former diplomatic editor. Because of where this war is concentrated, because it's happening in the Middle East, we do see that unusual economic impact, which you don't always get from wars elsewhere. The economic impact that spreads around the globe, the cost of oil, gas, interest rates on loans, mortgages, the cost of government borrowing, it's all drawn in. And Simon, every morning we wait for the markets to open. It's that moment where we see where something like the price of a barrel of oil will go. All of these different things. What are things looking at just now? Looking like just now?
So I've been looking at a few of the different things you just discussed there. So gas shot up over the last 24 hours to 186 pence per therm, which it has slipped back now about 15% to 153. Now, bear in mind, that is still double the rate at which it was before these hostilities began. So it seems inevitable that eventually people's gas bills will be going up. Remember, the consumers are protected by the energy price cap per unit, but then that keeps people protected till the end of June. Although some analysts, who very usefully kind of comprise what they think the next cap is going to look like, currently it's at $1,600 for an annual bill for dual fuel. Their latest figure was that it's going to be $1,800, although they're going to update that later on today, and it's possible we could get further towards $2,000. So clearly higher heating bills seem inevitable. On the oil front, again, it hit $119 a barrel, the Brent crude price, and it slipped back to $107. That is up 50% since the start of hostilities. We've seen already unleaded prices go from $132 to $142 for a litre, and diesel from $142 to $164. So that's an increase of around 15%. So that is showing up on the forecourts and will continue to trickle through, because it generally, as a rule of thumb, takes about 2 weeks for a price rise to make it on to the forecourt. So you're going to see those as well. And you mentioned government borrowing. And in a way, Rachel Reeves got a big boost in January when they had a surplus and tax receipts came in and they didn't borrow money. In fact, they had a surplus. We just found out that government had to borrow £14.3 billion in February, the second highest on record. Some timing differences there. But if you consider the cost of that debt is going up, 4.25%. There was the price they were having to borrow at from investors, and that's now 4.8%. So you can see that just about on every measure, both at the domestic and household level and at the government level, all these price changes are moving in the wrong direction and make it very challenging.
Yeah, that was a very comprehensive roundup. Lots of moving parts. Thank you, Simon. It's just going around to 25 past eight.
You turn your cast your mind back to the COVID era, that is people across the UK applauding health workers fighting to battle coronavirus. The COVID inquiry is approaching its end. It's been a 3-year examination of how close the NHS came to collapse, the efforts of those who prevented that, and how our relationship with government authority and intervention was tested. In a way, it's been an X-ray of the national character and its institutions. We got the report on the NHS module yesterday. Dr. Kevin Fong, consultant anaesthetist and lead for major incident planning at UCL hospitals, who has seconded to NHS England as National Clinical Advisor in emergency preparedness, resilience and response for the COVID-19 incident. He's here in the studio. Good morning to you, Kevin.
Morning.
You gave evidence. First of all, I mean, the verdict was the NHS coped, only just, but it coped. What did you make of it?
Yeah, I mean, coped is to put too fine a point. It was the closest strong thing we've ever seen. We got right up to the edge of operational collapse, and we only coped, as Baroness Hallett said, because of the extraordinary efforts of our frontline teams.
And what was, I mean, you gave evidence. What? Take us back to the evidence that you gave.
Well, in my time at NHS England, I was responsible for setting up and then running a series of visits into the hospitals around England. Visited more than 50 hospitals, and we did that because the data we were collecting and seeing on our spreadsheets did not capture their experiences. When you went in and you saw those people up close, you saw some of the hardest things, some of the worst things that I have ever seen in nearly 30 years of clinical practice, and that includes being on duty for terrorist incidents and major transport crashes. COVID was worse than that every single day of the pandemic for more than 2.5 years.
And what did we, the public, not see? What are the things that you saw under the skin of it that we didn't see?
Yeah, and understandably, we only ever see the best face of it in our media reporting. But in the hardest hit units, we saw teams stretched to their very limits. We had nurses talking about patients raining from the sky. We had them talking about going to work in bin liners and cagoules and waterproofs they'd raided from outdoor shops because they were out of PPE. I had one nursing team telling us that they ran out of body bags and were traumatised by having to put their patients in 9-foot clear plastic sacks and seal them with cable ties. And it goes on and on and on. And that was everywhere, every day. And it was only because of their efforts, only because of what they did, that the whole thing just didn't collapse.
And including, for example, sometimes death of colleagues. People would sometimes be admitted to the ICUs they were working.
So our staff did not escape the risk of infection. In fact, quite the reverse. They were 4 times more likely to be infected, twice as likely to go into hospital. One of the matrons of one of the intensive care units I went to talked about a day when no fewer than 10 patients died on her unit in a single shift, and 2 of them were their own hospital staff. Mm. So this came at enormous risk to these people, and yet they still turned up and they still did it.
And you say that it survived because of the superhuman efforts of the people who worked there. Despite what? What, underfunding, poor organisation? What are the lessons?
So Baroness Hallett is very clear in her report, isn't she, that she says that on the eve of COVID, the NHS was under-resourced and under-equipped. It was already in a fragile state. And so to close the gap between the enormous demand that is produced by COVID and the supply that existed, we had to throw the staff into that. And that is what we need to learn from the Cope Inquiry.
And what confidence do you have that those lessons have been there? Have you seen any evidence that the learning... Because this report is... You gave evidence 2 years ago. This is a long old inquiry, this. What's happened in the interim?
Well, I mean, the report has only just been published, so we can only hope. But the serious and takeaway message for us, the single lever that I would like to see pulled now as a result of what we've learned in the Module 3 Inquiry Report, is that we must look after our frontline teams. They are the NHS. If you could do one thing, you want to invest in promoting, protecting their well-being so that they are there when we need them.
What do you mean by look after? Do you mean in terms of show appreciation, like clapping pots and pans? Do you mean paying them more? Do you mean making sure there's the appropriate PPE available?
So, all of the above. I mean, the pots and pans thing, I think people found a little bit irritating after a while, because that on its own is kind of a hollow gesture, because what follows is the understanding that about a half to two-thirds of all the money that's spent, the £200 billion that's spent on the health service and social care, is spent on the teams. But they are going sick at a higher rate than ever before. They are leaving at a higher rate than ever before. We have trouble retaining them. And so there is an overwhelming moral case to invest in their working conditions and their pay. But there is also a business case to do that. In some analyses, you can save between £1 and £3 billion a year if you could just improve, reduce their rates of sickness, improve their retention, and keep them on the shop floor more effectively. You know, the best way to make sure that we have more staff on the shop floor next Christmas is to stop them leaving at the rate that they are.
They often say in corporations, you know, our biggest assets are people. Like, what you're saying is it couldn't be more true for the NHS.
Well, what does the COVID Inquiry Report tell you? It tells you that the people did the job.
What do you think, if something like similar sort of befall us again, and you know, it won't be the same as last time, it never is, as the next crisis is always different, what comment do you think that we, or do we have organisational memory of this that would help us?
Well, this is the fear. I think that if you ran into another pandemic now, you know, God forbid, the organisational memory is there because some of the people who worked the last pandemic are still in service. But within 10, 15 years, they won't be. And so there is an responding to the recommendations of the inquiry is urgent, because if we don't, we won't capture that organisational memory and we will start from zero the next time. And so that is the importance of the inquiry. That is the importance of the recommendations. They must respond.
Do you think, and also just a final thought, do you think that this memory we have is an asset which can be used, or is it, are people still slightly scarred by it, do you think?
So in clinical practice, whenever we come over a difficult incident where someone has been harmed or someone has died, we comb over the wreckage of that. Why? Because we're trying to preserve the memory, to cash it in, to give us a chance to escape to a better future from the learning. So it is an opportunity and we should use it as such, but that means some urgent attention to what is recommended.
Okay. Dr. Kevin Fong, consultant anaesthetist and lead for major incident planning at UCL Hospitals, who was, as I say, very involved in the NHS England response to that. Thank you very much for coming in.
It's just after 8:30. Let's check the sport. Here's Mike.
Anna, thank you. For the first time in 30 years, Nottingham Forest are into a European quarterfinal. A penalty shootout victory in their last 16 second leg ties sent them through to the last eight last night, where they will face Porto in the Europa League. Aston Villa are also through to the quarterfinals. They will meet Bologna. Crystal Palace will meet Fiorentina in the last eight of the Europa Conference League. Now, if you were listening this time yesterday, you will have heard us talking to Isabel Boffi, one of the rising stars of the GB team, heading out to Poland for this weekend's World Athletics Indoor Championships, which start later today. And we can get a more general overview of those championships now. Delighted to say Paula Radcliffe joins us live from Poland. Hi, Paula.
Hi, how are you?
Really well, thank you. So they get underway in less than an hour's time, don't they, these World Indoors?
Yeah.
So let's start, I guess, with the biggest name in this British team, one of the biggest stars in world athletics, you have to say, Olympic 800 metres champion Keely Hodgkinson. She's red hot favourite, isn't she, for gold at these championships? I know she's got heats this morning. She's not won a World Indoor medal yet, though, in her career. This is the last one for her to claim.
No, she hasn't. And she has had a bit of a few mishaps, let's say, coming into previous world champs, which have meant she's not even been able to get out there and compete, which is perhaps why she hasn't got a medal. So she comes into this one really healthy, really in a good place psychologically. Was watching her at the press conference yesterday. She gets underway in the first of the heats and hasn't really got a huge amount of competition in that. So it's kind of up to her, I think, how she wants to run those rounds and probably... Knowing Keely would like to make a statement in the final as well.
And she's got history on this track, hasn't she, out in Poland? Won her first major medal there at the European Indoors as a 19-year-old 5 years ago.
Yes, and she talked about that and the happy memories. And that always helps, I think, coming back to somewhere that you have good memories of already having performed really well. She can draw on those and she will have visualised a lot of times. Actually, sometimes trickier going through those heats when everybody is expecting you to easily win, easily advance, that adds kind of a little bit more pressure without having the adrenaline flowing that you would normally have if it is really tough qualifying conditions. So, don't have any doubts about Keely. I know she's proven time and time again how mature a competitor she is, so much so that we forget her actual age sometimes.
Other British names to look out for this weekend. How about Josh Kerr in the men's 3,000 metres?
Absolutely. And Josh is coming back from that calf tear that he sustained in the closing stages of Tokyo at the World Championships. He's recovered really well from that, trained well, perhaps not raced yet as well as he would like to. But I think those couple of races that he has done will have brought him on and put him in a good position. And he looked, again, good doing his final strides and workout yesterday and probably excited and ready to go. We also have Izzy Boffi, of course, as you mentioned, going in the final of the 800 heats for the women this morning, and then Ben Patterson in the men's.
And just away from the Brits, Paula, some other international stars to keep our eye on. I noticed there are 9 individual Olympic champions at these championships, so a very strong field, including the likes of women's 100 metres champion Julian Alfred and the Swedish pole vault star Armand Duplantis there as well.
Exactly. Mondo, like Keely, coming off having, as well, he didn't get in his first world record. He improved his 15th, I think. So, yeah, a lot of people excited to see what he can do. And can he jump another world record here in Torren?
And in a non-Olympic, non-World Championship year, I guess important to say that these World Indoors, along with the Commonwealth Games, I guess, in July, are the two biggest track and field events of the year.
Yes, I mean, we have the European Championships as well in Birmingham. So these athletes have kind of got a lesser year in terms of the World Championship Olympic level. We do also have the Ultimate Championships in September. So they do have some kind of World Championships to aim for, but it's slightly different format and in its first time out. So we'll see what that's like in September.
Busy few days off track and field awaits. I'll let you get away to the coverage, which starts very shortly. Paula Radcliffe, a big part of that across the BBC. As we say, they're getting underway at 9 o'clock this morning out in Poland. And you can watch the World Indoor Athletics on BBC Two, the iPlayer and the BBC Sport website.
Thanks very much indeed, Mike. It is 24 minutes to nine. At 9 o'clock, it'll be Desert Island Discs. Here's Lauren Laverne with her latest Castaway.
My castaway this week is the heart surgeon and writer, Professor Stephen Westerby.
When I first saw a heart, I was just totally mesmerised by its rhythm, its efficiency, the way one set of chambers contract and then the second set of chambers contract to pump the blood round the body into the lungs. It's a beautiful thing.
Professor Stephen Westerby, My Castaway. Do join us to hear his Desert Island Discs this morning at 9.
The weather today is promising, actually. There's some areas of mist and fog that will be slow to clear this morning, particularly in eastern England, but beyond that, plenty of warm sunshine to enjoy.
Hooray. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Anna Foster in Salford, Simon Jack in London, and Lisa Costello has a summary of the news.
Israel says it's carried out another wave of airstrikes on the Iranian capital, Tehran, but there's been a slight fall in oil and gas prices after Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said he would hold off any future attacks on Iranian gas fields. The United Arab Emirates, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia and Bahrain have all reported they're responding to Iranian missile and drone attacks. Figures released this morning show the government borrowed more than £14 billion last month. That's more than economists had forecast and the second highest February figure since records began in 1993. The father of a sixth form student who died in the meningitis B outbreak in Kent has joined calls for the national vaccination programme to be extended to teenagers and young adults. Michael Kenny's 18-year-old daughter Juliet is one of two people who lost their lives in the outbreak. Attending a football match in England and Wales without a ticket has become a criminal offence. Offenders will face a banning order of up to 5 years as well as a fine of up to £1,000.
Thanks, Lisa. 22 minutes to nine. On yesterday's programme, Amal visited Colchester in Essex and spent some time with a family who had school-aged children at home on reduced timetables as their schools were not able to meet either their special educational needs or behavioural needs full-time. Nicola from Greenstead Community Centre told Amal that she sees large numbers of local primary and secondary children walking around as they're not at school on their reduced timetable.
Seniors school up the road have got so many, I was shocked how many were going in and out at different times of the day. That makes it hard for parents to work.
Just to be really clear, what we're talking about here is children, often themselves from families in poverty, who go to school, but the school is so stretched that they give them a part-time timetable, which means it could be coming at 11 o'clock, it could be don't come in on a Monday. Yeah. So you've got primary and secondary school aged children being sent home from school to do what?
Well, they're meant to be educating at home, but obviously some of the parents can't. They're probably not, and they're probably meeting others, and they're probably getting in trouble. Or they may be in their bedrooms on their game console, not meeting anybody, talking to anyone, and then when it goes into society, they're not going to cope with work.
Well, that's Nicola from Greenstead Community Centre, and we decided to look a bit deeper into this and found that in England's schools, 39,000 children are on part-time reduced timetables. Amy Bradley is a mother of three autistic children and founded the Send Sanctuary UK, a national parent-led network of over 35,000 families campaigning for accountability and inclusion for children with special educational needs and disabilities. And also on the line, Kieran Gill, founder and chief executive of the charity The Difference. Good morning to you both. Amy, can I come to you first? You've got three children with SEND.
Yes.
You've got a four-year-old due to start school in September and doesn't have a place. Why not?
So there's no schools at the moment that can meet need. So I've had over 10 responses from mainstream primary schools. None of them can meet his EHCP Section F. And we only have three specialist provisions locally, and they're all full.
Yeah. And what does that mean practically is going to happen then?
I mean, I'm going to go down the legal route. I'm hoping to get to tribunal this summer before he starts school. For some families, they don't understand how the legal route works, so they end up putting their child into a mainstream school, and that's when it all goes wrong. Mm.
And because you've actually got two other children, one 13-year-old with ADHD who is in mainstream school, with a middle child in a specialist school. What's been your experience? And talk us through how these different options work.
So for my daughter, she's autistic with ADHD, and for her, she can work really well in a mainstream school with good high support. So she's got a really robust EHCP. She has a great school that implement everything, and she's thriving. My son, my middle child, he is autistic. He's got a severe learning disability, and he was given a mainstream setting and I refused to send him. We went to tribunal and got a specialist provision. And when he started in reception, he had no language at all. And now we have some words. He's thriving. He's where we never thought he would be. We never thought we would hear his voice. And it just goes to show what the right settings and support can do for a child so that they can thrive. Mm.
Kieran Gill, from the Chief Executive of the Educational Charity, The Difference. I think you know Amy as well.
We do.
You know each other. What is the lesson from this? I mean, it sounds like, you know, there's no one, you know, one size fits all solution to this, but that requires a great deal of flexibility and presumably cost as well.
Well, it is a real lot of challenge that schools are dealing with in the moment in terms of rising anxiety. We heard about poverty earlier in the piece, and these are all factors. And we should be worried about nearly 40,000 children on part-time timetables last year. That data is by FFT Data Lab, by the way. But in some ways, it's sort of the tip of the iceberg. There are lots of young people struggling to be in school. We published a piece of research with IPPR called Who's Losing Learning? And the part-time timetable stat was alongside 30,000 children who are moving across schools sort of invisibly under the radar, 20,000 who are missing from schools altogether, 120,000 whose parents are unenrolling them, putting them in an elective home education, but sometimes they're actually really keen to get them back into another mainstream school. So this is a really big picture, and it's great that the Today programme is shining light on it. I think schools, it's brilliant to hear Amy's middle child thriving in mainstream school. And The Difference finds that when school leaders particularly have the right support, can put the right strategy in place and really invest, as you say, in upskilling their staff, we can get more and more children with needs, which might be long term or might be sort of emerging and transient. We can get those students supported with the right thing and back in class. But it does require, absolutely dedication from a head teacher and support.
I think we should also make clear that some of these reduced timetables are because of behavioural difficulties as well, not necessarily just special educational needs and development, just to make that clear. Amy, what would you like to see the government do? There's a 2026 white paper, as a draft law, putting children and young people first. What is in that or not in that you like or don't like?
I understand, you know, they want to make mainstream inclusive, but for some children, especially those who are on reduced timetables, you know, they're not short term. There's children only going for 30 minutes a day. They have got trauma from that school. They cannot be integrated back into that setting. They're going to have to go to a specialist setting or a completely different school to be reintegrated. There's not enough about emotional based school avoidance or, you know, home education. I can't remember what it's called now. It begins with E. You know, there's nothing about that in there. There's not enough more specialist actual schools being put into the white paper where some children really need to go to, because mainstream will not be a one size fits all for everyone. I think it's amazing that they want to make it more inclusive. But, you know, for these children, trying to get them back into the mainstream school that has caused the trauma, it might not work and it probably won't work. And these children are then completely out of education. And calling 30 minutes a day an education it's not.
Yeah. And Kieran, is there a threshold at which of non-engagement in school where the timetable becomes so reduced it sort of becomes very hard to re-engage in any school setting?
Well, sadly, we don't have enough data on part-time timetables, and that must improve. But we do have data on attendance that actually the department is sharing with schools. And it is much harder to re-engage a young person, as Amy says, who's got so sort of estranged from their peers, from their school, on a part-time timetable and re-engage them. It's much easier to catch things when anxiety, perhaps additional needs kind of emerging in the classroom are first being seen, when a child has started to struggle to come to school or be late repeatedly. And that's what the difference helps school leaders do, sort of spot that data and act preventatively. But I should also say that, you know, some schools are really getting this right. The difference has supported a school in setting up an inclusion base, and that is part of the government policy, that more schools should have resources, services that can work across students. And they've brought in students who were previously on part-time timetables, who are now, they have high anxiety, but they're actually accessing the same English lesson as their peers via Zoom from another room within the school, and that is helping keep relationships with peers at break time and lunchtime, keep relationships with teachers and get students back in class. And that's possible because the whole school has actually reduced the use of a sort of removal room space by working out when behaviours are erupting in class, what's behind that. Is it a literacy need? Is it a challenge at home, maybe a bereavement? And what is the input that a child needs to get them back into lessons? So I do want to strike a hopeful note that I actually do think we can address this. Many school leaders walking towards this do, and the difference helps them do that. But we do need to make sure that the government's ambition is backed up by research into what works in these spaces, because it's not right that those children should be should be languishing.
Listen, we're going to have to leave it there. Kieran Gill, founder and CEO of The Difference, and Amy Bradley, I wish you all the best with your young four-year-old. I hope gets the right solution, and thank you for our follow-up into that issue of reduced time tools. Thank you both.
It's 13 minutes to nine now. The government set out which countries and projects will lose funding as a result of cuts to the overseas aid budget, with that money being rediverted towards defence spending instead. Places like Ukraine, Gaza, Sudan and Lebanon will have their funding protected for now, but Mozambique and Pakistan, among others, will not, and will see deep cuts to their development programmes. Well, Romany Greenhill is with us, Chief Executive of the Development Network Bond. Good morning.
Good morning.
Which of these cuts concern you the most?
Well, all of the cuts, I have to say, concern me. And I think this is really the sort of harsh reality of the decision to cut the aid budget a year ago. This is the harsh reality laid bare. The government's own impact assessment is showing, for example, fewer girls and children with disabilities able to go to school in South Sudan, women and children no longer able to get access to life-saving health service in Somalia. These are really devastating cuts. And the other thing that concerns me is that we were making so much progress. Over the last two decades, we've seen significant progress in development. You know, UK aid in 2015 to 2018, it was vaccinating one child every second, saving millions of lives. And that progress is now really under threat and likely to go into reverse.
It can be a really difficult sell for politicians, can't it? Foreign aid, things that people in this country don't see in front of them with their own eyes. There's a time of war. Defence spending sounds like the right thing to prioritise. What do you say in response to that?
So I completely understand that people want to be safe. You know, that is very natural, and it's right that the government protects its citizens. But these cuts actually are going to make us less safe, not more safe. They're going to make us less able to respond to global health threats, for example. You know, we saw the COVID pandemic a few years ago. Diseases don't respect borders. Something that starts in another country can easily impact us here. Think about Sierra Leone. They're now seeing big cuts to their health system, big cuts from UK aid to health. Now, Sierra Leone is where the Ebola outbreak first started a few years ago. A lot of people here in the UK may not have heard of Ebola, and there's a reason for that. It never came here. At the time, there were high levels of UK aid. We worked with partners in Sierra Leone and other parts of West Africa. That outbreak was tackled at source. That was obviously very good for the people in those countries, but it was also good for people here because the Ebola never came here and never impacted people in Britain. So my main message is, you know, I understand government wants to keep people safe in this country, but these cuts will make us less safe in the long run.
Romilly Greenhill, the Chief Executive of the Development Network Bond, thank you for being with us. It's 10 to 9 now. On a slightly different topic, it is the time of year when the spring flowers are starting to bloom. And I mean, do you ever take a moment to think about how the more rare and exotic ones around us actually got here? Possibly not, but there is a new exhibition at the Ashmolean Museum in Oxford, which is exploring just that. Everything from tulips to poppies to orchids having their roots examined, yeah. Dr. Francesca Leone is one of the curators of the In Bloom exhibition. Doctor, good morning.
Good morning, Anna.
We don't always think of things like poppies and tulips as exotic, but actually when you dig into some of these varieties, their backstories are really fascinating.
Very true. I mean, tulips, for instance, come from a very far away. They grow naturally in Central Asia, and it took several centuries for them to actually come across through West Asia into Europe, taking Europe by a storm, as you know, because I'm sure that you are familiar with the story of Tulipomania and the way in which this flower completely transformed economies and gardens, in fact.
And when we move, as you say, that there are those that we see around us all the time, and then things like, you know, camellias and peonies, orchids, and what you're doing, you know, sort of drawing all of these things together in the exhibition.
We are charting the stories of these flowers because we are charting the stories of the people who got involved with them. And so we follow them through explorers, scientific codification, and we follow their difficult journeys as well, the impact more broadly on people and environment as these plants were moved from a part of the world to another, in order to suit and satisfy new fashions, new interests. As we worked on the exhibition, we realized how closely tied our own habits and our own histories as people are to the plants that surround us. And so it was interesting to actually follow some of those journeys across time and space, which is what the exhibition tries to do.
Yeah. And I suppose as well, you're talking about people and the links between plants and flowers and people. I suppose for centuries, that perhaps wish to turn away from some of the more difficult elements of the world and just be drawn into nature. I suppose that's not a new thing at all, is it?
Not at all. And it was a sense of wonder that drove us to plants. You know, we begin in particular with the story of the Tredescans, two gardeners, whose collection eventually is the founding collection of the Ashmolean itself. And their constant wonderment, that their constant exploration of the natural world as they added to the gardens of their, you know, patrons, and as they really transformed the world around them. But they were driven by curiosity. They were driven by interest before plants became an object of material desire, of trade, and a commodity, effectively, like many others. There are individuals in the exhibition who found solace in nature and cultivating plants, trying to find both physical and mental remedies in them. And so all these stories kind of interwove together as we explore, you know, the more familiar ones through wonderful works of art. At the end of today, as an art exhibition, we use art objects as hooks to investigate
those things together. Sounds beautiful.
Things, yeah.
Thank you for telling us about it. Dr. Francesca Leone, one of the curators of the In Bloom exhibition at the Ashmolean Museum in Oxford.
Nearly 5 to 9, when Liam Gallagher and Patsy Kensit were pictured on magazine covers as the face of 90s Britpop and Cool Britannia, it was a direct copy of images of Mick Jagger and Marianne Faithfull, who'd been the original icons of British music and fashion. And Mick is still going strong, of course, but Marianne died aged 78 in January last year. But a new documentary about her life shows there is much more to her than being Mick Jagger's girlfriend.
I didn't have a normal process growing up. I went straight from school into the pop business.
I never saw myself as a pop singer.
You were split between
who I really am, yeah, what they wanted, yeah, me to be.
She was a spanner in the works.
Well, Ian Forsyth and Jane Pollard, BAFTA-nominated directors, are of Broken English, which is the name, I think, of her critically acclaimed album after many years in the wilderness. They're both with me in the studio. What drew you, Jane, to Marianne Faithfull? Did you know her? Did you know anything about her? What was the draw?
You know, we'd grown up fallen foul to just believing the lie, the misogynist lie that was told about her. And as a kid...
The lie being that she was just Mick Jagger's girlfriend and...
No, it was a horrible lie that a policeman made up and later admitted after Redlands.
Okay.
And she... And I guess to our generation, that really, her whole reputation as an artist had got stuck. She was just simply that, you know? And then... So many musicians that we absolutely adore, Nick Cave, PJ Harvey, Anna Calvi, all started to work with her. And over the last sort of 10 years, and that made us take notice. So when our producer Beth Earle brought the project to us, it was a great chance to learn, to rediscover this remarkable artist.
Yeah. And what was it, Ian, about her as an artist that we're missing?
I think she had a really quite remarkable ability to keep going. And I think the great lesson that I took from getting to know Marianne over the last 4 years of her life is that that's what matters. The work matters. Just keep going, keep going, keep going, and don't get distracted. And that was, you know, really what her life was about. She lived for her work, and her work was everything to her.
Because she had her, obviously, distractions, as you say, but in her own words, I read some of her own comments about her. She said she disappeared down a sewer. There was her heroin addiction in that. And yet, you know, I do know some people who knew her even during those periods and said they were still, she was still a remarkable person during that period.
Oh, absolutely. Her whole life, her whole world is churned through the mill of the imagination. She lived the kind of literary influences that she was fiercely intelligent, and so we had to make a film that matched that in some way, that was heightened in theatricality and that met her creativity. So we created right at the heart of it the Ministry of Not Forgetting.
Well, to explain what that is, because I underline that and say, what is the Ministry of Not Forgetting?
The Ministry of Not Forgetting is a dramatic conceit that allows us to take a sort of sideways step through Marianne's life story. But really, what it's an institution that we invented that is headed up by Tilda Swinton, and she acts in the film as the overseer of this institution. And the task that they've been given is to recalibrate Marianne Faithfull's legacy. So we go on that journey with them, and we discover things about Marianne as they're discovering them, so that we have perhaps something more of a detective story, and we get to explore the process that we went through getting to know her.
And you see the sexism, which is the misogynism, which is at heart about that in our appraisal of her. Because if you think about, you know, there's plenty of bad boys of rock, isn't there? You talk about Keith Richards, I mean, he's still going, but, you know, he, in a way, he's sort of garlanded for the way he's lived his life, whereas Marianne not.
Yeah, I think that we have to admit that we have ingrained double standards. There's an absolute hypocrisy about the characteristics that we're happy for our male artists to have and display in the bad behaviour, but we simply judge our female artists negatively for the same things. We've got to get beyond that.
Okay, well, thank you both very much for coming in. And that documentary, Broken English, is out today in cinemas. And if that's left you wanting not just the documentary, but even more